Good Monday to you. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, coming to you today from beautiful Farmville, Virginia, site of the 2016 vice presidential debate / MMA fight. I'm not sure if it's officially been announced yet, but I imagine the way things are going, that's probably where we'll be by the time October rolls around. Coming up on the program today, John Cardillo will join us, host of the John Cardillo Show, former New York police officer. We'll talk about a story that appeared over the weekend. I think this was in the Washington Post. Cities begin to challenge a bedrock of justice. They are paying criminals not to kill. A monthly stipend up to $1,000. If you are selected for this fellowship program, this is basically based on something they're doing in Richmond, California, where they have this fellowship program. They've identified individuals who are the most likely to both be engaged in violence and be a victim of violence. And they basically say, listen, if you go to counseling, if you I don't think call it counseling, if you take these steps, if you stay out of trouble, if you don't commit a crime, we'll pay you money. It is not an indefinite program. In Richmond, California, it lasts about 18 months. Supporters of the program say, look, four out of five of the fellows that have gone through this program have stayed out of trouble. They haven't shot anybody. They haven't been shot. Now, I say four out of five. There have been a couple of individuals in the program who actually are accused of killing each other. But the program has its supporters and has its detractors. Among the supporters are members of the Washington, D.C. City Council who want to take this program to our nation's capital, use taxpayer funds, and really expand the size and scope of this program. Richmond, California has about 100,000 residents. Same city where, again, about 17 individuals were found to be responsible for, what was it, like 80% of the shootings in the city? So, again, the idea being, well, let's find those 17 individuals and let's get them to stop killing each other. One way to do that is, again, saying we're going to help you turn your life around. I happen to think another very important part of this is the not the empty threat, but the promise that if you don't turn your life around, this is it. This is society's last offer of help before you go to the criminal justice system. And there are no plea bargains. There are no sweetheart deals. You're going away for a long, long time because this is it. This is our last-ditch attempt to make your life something worthwhile. If you don't want to help, you don't want to do it, okay, we're done. In Washington, D.C., you got about 500,000 people. So let's say the problem is five times as big. Now instead of 17 individuals responsible for a majority of violent crime, now you're dealing with more than 100 individuals. That loose social network, remember in Chicago, well, we talked last week of the program about 6% of the population is at risk of being shot and killed or doing the killings. And the more individuals you know within that 6% of the population, the more likely you are to be drawn into that web of violence as well. So how big a program are we looking at here in Washington, D.C.? 500,000 people, say roughly again, 6% of the population. That's a not insubstantial number of folks that you're trying to target. Smaller than Chicago, a city of about 2.7 million. But this proposal is proven to be pretty controversial there in the District of Columbia. And it's interesting because, again, I'm hearing a lot of talk about the efforts like this, but I'm not hearing much talk about the other aspect of this. that if you fail, if you decide, man, this isn't life for me, I want to go back to what I was doing before, that there are consequences for that. I'm not hearing much about the consequences. So we'll talk again with John Cardillo later on in the hour. Next hour, Staff Sergeant Brian Mast, U.S. Army retired. He's a former bomb tech with the Joint Special Operations Command. He was a Department of Homeland Security explosive specialist. Talking about the bombs that were used in Brussels. Because this is, you know, again, we've seen all kinds of efforts to turn the attacks in Brussels to whatever political purpose. I saw somebody on MSNBC, of course it had to be MSNBC, try to use this to talk about gun control laws. But beyond all of the excuses to offer up your own opinion about your own, you know, pet topic, there are some facts that I think are worthy of discussion. And part of it is, you know, these bombs that were used in Brussels apparently are fairly easy to assemble, which is kind of scary. And Brian Mast, unfortunately, has some experience with this stuff. And he's concerned, too, about our ability to spot these types of explosives. He's concerned about our level of professionalism within the security ranks. So I'm not promising a positive, rosy conversation there with Staff Sergeant Brian Mast from the U.S. Army retired, but I think it's going to be an important conversation. Jim Wallace will join us next hour as well from the Gun Owners Action League up in Massachusetts. Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom joining us in Hour 3 with the Liberty Update. Tony Bernardo from the Canadian Institute for Legislative Action talking about the proposed gun registry there in Quebec. I say proposed. There's been all kinds of political wrangling back and forth. This was supposedly a very popular measure when the long gun registry ultimately went away at the federal level in Canada a couple of years ago. The government there in Quebec vowed that they would have their own long gun registry because that's what good gun control supporting people do. They call for registries. And they sued to get access to the federal government's records on Quebecers. And they were told, you can't have it. So they decided, okay, well, again, we're going to set up our own. And then as the political wheels started grinding, something really interesting happened. In Quebec, supposedly there was really supposed to be no pro-gun sentiment at all. Oh, there started to be a lot of opposition to this long gun registry. A petition, I believe, over 30,000 Quebecers signing, saying, no, we don't want this. Members of the parties that typically support and promote gun control, hearing for a while that they would be able to have a free vote, they could vote their conscience. Now, no, they're whipping the parties here. You are expected to vote the way the party tells you to vote, which, again, if there wasn't concern about how that free vote would go, probably wouldn't see the need to force the party line on the members of parliament there. So it's fascinating what we're seeing. And now the latest wrench thrown into the works here is the financial impact that creating the registry might have. You've got some, again, supporters of the registry saying, it'll be worse if we don't start a registry. And then you have, again, opponents of the registry pointing out what happened at the federal level, all of the money that was spent for nothing. For nothing. Do you really want to replicate that at the regional level? Have you not learned your lesson yet? Again, we'll talk about it with Tony Bernardo in Hour 3. Plus, we have the hero of the day, the deal of the day, and the good guy coming up. Hillary Clinton was featured in the page of the New York Daily News over the weekend. with an anti-gun, anti-NRA op-ed saying that she has met with the family members of those who have been killed due to violent crime, and that she has some proposals. Now, it's interesting. She points out in 2012, the New York Daily News reported that just five of New York's 76 police precincts account for a quarter of all shootings. She said, if you're reading this from one of the other 71 precincts, the epidemic of gun violence may feel like something from another world. In some zip codes, a full year can pass without a single murder being committed. She's right. Again, in Chicago, about 6% of the population is at high risk of both committing violent crimes and being the victim of violent crimes. To put it another way, something that we say on this program quite a bit, even in the worst neighborhoods, there are far more good people than bad living there. Right? There is a relatively small number of violent criminals in this country. There are a relatively small number of violent crimes in this country compared to the general population. We are not all out there committing violent crimes. In fact, the vast majority of us will never commit a violent crime. So her specific proposals, not one of them actually talk about the people who are committing the violent crimes. Not one. She says, first, we need to repeal the law that gives the gun industry sweeping liability protections so companies that make and sell guns can be held accountable when their products kill people. Again, not the individual held accountable, but the firearms manufacturer held accountable for the actions of that individual. When the NRA pushed that misguided law she wrote through Congress, they said that preventing lawsuits was their top legislative priority. Now it's making it harder for families who lost children in the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary in Newtown, Connecticut, to sue Bushmaster for marketing its AR-15 assault rifle to civilians. As president, she says, I'll stand with the families victimized by guns, not the corporations that profit from them. So, again, let's not talk about the individuals who are committing these violent crimes. Again, the relatively small number of Americans. Let's talk about the manufacturers of those firearms. Let's go after them instead. Second, she says, we should implement comprehensive background checks. President Obama recently issued several executive orders designed to strengthen this federal system. Surveys, she says, have shown that even 85% of gun owners favor these checks. And it's hard to believe, she says, that we still allow people on the no-fly list to purchase firearms. I think it's pretty simple. If it's too dangerous for you to be allowed on an airplane, it's too dangerous for you to own a gun. So Ted Kennedy, then, he was, yeah. You know, if you listen to this program on a regular basis, you've heard me talk about the no-fly list. It's actually the, and it'd be nice to get some clarification from Hillary Clinton. Is she talking specifically about the no-fly list, or is she talking about the legislation that's been proposed, which uses the much broader terror watch list? Because here's the problem. Just because your name's on that list doesn't mean that you're actually suspected of being a terrorist. The people who actually work to put names on that list will tell you that. There are names that are on there because of a common spelling or a common name. There are names that are on there because you may live near someone who's a person of interest. You may work with someone who's a person of interest. If you are on the no-fly list, and by the way, the ACLU, it's interesting because, you know, they don't want to come out and say, yay, Second Amendment. But they have actually come out and said, you know, look, we're not saying that there should be lists of people who can't buy or buy guns, because that's, we don't really want to get into that. But we have an objection to the no-fly list in principle and how it's being administered. You don't know how you get on. You don't really know how you get off. The average American who finds themselves on that list erroneously can spend years applying for relief. So, no. By the way, without ever being suspected of a crime. So, no, if we're going to start losing our rights, we're going to take away their car keys, too. I'm just curious. Third, she says, we need to close the so-called Charleston loophole. She says, right now, a person with an arrest record can walk into a gun store to buy a gun, and if their background check isn't completed within 3 business days, they can walk out with a firearm. It makes absolutely no sense. She says, more than 55,000 gun sales that would otherwise have been blocked have been allowed to proceed because of this loophole. One of them was the gun bought by the white supremacist who murdered 9 parishioners at Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston last year. So how long should it be? She says that this loophole isn't the result of some accidental oversight, and the law was created by a standalone amendment designed and written by the gun lobby. She doesn't say what exactly she would do to it, other than that it would change, perhaps indefinitely. As long as the check doesn't come back, then the purchase cannot proceed. Don't know. I do know this. In all of these stories that we're seeing out of Chicago with violent crime and the increase, I haven't seen one person quoted as saying any of these things would make a difference. Not one. Look at a story from the New York Times. Violence surges in Chicago even as policing debate rages on. And we'll talk about this when we return from a break. John Cardillo is going to join us because this fits in really well here. Violence is exploding right now in Chicago. And you would be hard-pressed to find people who live in the most violent neighborhoods. Those average residents. You'd be hard-pressed to find any of them who would say, you know, I think really what we need are another round of gun control laws. But yeah, that's what we're hearing from Hillary Clinton. Well, we're going to talk with former New York police officer John Cardillo about paying people not to commit violent crimes, about another round of gun control laws to prevent violent crimes, aimed at law-abiding Americans, by the way, and about what we might really do to start to reverse this hopefully short-lived trend in increasing violence in more of our American cities. Stick around. We are just getting started here on this Monday edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler.
I'm speaking with Sergeant Major Lance Nutt. He's president and founder of Sheepdog Impact Assistance. Tell us what Sheepdog Impact Assistance is all about.
Well, when we refer to the term of sheepdog, it's referring to one of society's protectors. It's the men and women that serve in the military, law enforcement, fire and rescue ranks. It's that type of man or woman that's willing to put their life on the line for you and me, for everyday service and the things that we live and take for granted. It takes a unique individual to go out there and make sure that we're able to appreciate the freedoms that exist for us. And when we talk about society's protectors, it's truly its sheepdogs, those men and women willing to give it all.
So where did this concept come from?
Well, for us and myself as a Marine of 28 years, it was quickly understanding with multiple deployments under my back and so many of my own Marines and soldiers and sailors that I had served with, seeing the difficulties they had in returning home. Part of that was that continued service opportunity. When you step away from something that means so much to you and having given so much of your life in service, we felt that we needed an organization that would give you that opportunity to continue giving back to your country. And we initially formed as a disaster response organization and have morphed into so much more that truly defines who and what we are as individuals, our members and our volunteers. But more importantly, we're making sure that those men and women that have suffered a traumatic injury, and that could be emotional or physical trauma, that we give them the opportunity to get up off their butts and continue to live their lives.
It's awesome. Sergeant Major Lance Nutt with Sheepdog Impact Assistance. How can we get more information about your wonderful organization?
Well, we encourage people to visit our website at www.sheepdogia.org, and that'll give them an opportunity to learn a lot more about what we're accomplishing and how we're helping these men and women continue on with their lives.
Thank you, sir. Thanks for what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA News.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
speaking with Bill Poole. He is Managing Director, NRA Education and Training Division. Bill, let's talk about the NRA Basics of Pistol Shooting course. I understand some of it's now available online. Tell us about it.
Yes, John. It's called blended learning. That means that part of the course is online. It's about a 7.5-hour online training section that the students can complete in the comforts of their own home on their own schedule. And then once they've completed the online or the e-learning module, then they can contact an NRA-certified instructor who will take them to the range and check out their skills, make sure their safe gun handling is at its top, and that their marksmanship skills are just as good as it needs to be.
So this is the NRA Basics of Pistol Shooting course, which is, Bill, such a great course and such a great thing. You guys have kind of jiggered things up a little bit there to make it easier for people to do, right?
It is easier, but I don't want anybody to think that that means that it's shorter or less comprehensive. It's about 7.5 hours of seat time when you take the e-learning module, and then about another 5 hours of time when you go shooting. But the good news is the shooting portion can be all done in one day, in half a day, and so it's going to meet the needs of our students' schedules much better than we've been able to do in the past.
I love it. So then get the book learning part done, then get out there to the range with an NRA-certified instructor and finish it all up. It's a great idea, this blended learning course. So, Bill, how can folks get more information about this? How can they sign up? How do they do it?
First step is go to our webpage. It's onlinetraining.nra.org, and I hope they all do it today.
Why should folks check out the NRA Basics of Pistol Shooting course?
It is one of the most vibrant, robust e-learning training courses they're ever going to encounter. There's video, there are 3D pictures. You can listen to it. You can read it. I mean, we've used every modality teachers know how to use. It's an excellent course.
Could have said it better myself, Bill Poole. Thank you so much, sir. Welcome back. Thank you so much for being a part of this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler. John Cardillo, host of the John Cardillo Show, is with us on the program. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I am excellent. I appreciate you coming on the program. We have a lot of stuff to talk about, John. I have a lot of things that I want to throw at you here, including what we actually asked you to talk about. This piece at the Washington Post over the weekend. Cities begin to challenge a bedrock of justice. They are paying criminals not to kill. I kind of set this up in the first segment, talking about Richmond, California, a city that has instituted this fellowship program where basically they take those most at risk of committing violent crimes. They say, listen, go to these therapy courses. They don't call them therapy. You sit down with some counselors. Let's try to get you to build a life plan for yourself that doesn't involve violence. And as long as you're part of the program, which lasts about a year and a half, we will pay you as much as $1,000 a month, maybe as low as $1 a month. But we'll reward you for staying on the straight and narrow path. And now Washington, D.C. wants to replicate this, make it a lot bigger there in the District of Columbia. And I'm curious, John, what is your take on a program like this?
I think it's moronic. We're paying gangbangers. We're paying gangbangers $1,000 not to be gangbangers. $1,000 a month in some cases. Look, talk to any cop about this. They know that when you start paying bad guys, it's a one-way street. And all we got to do is look at a really famous case, right? Whitey Bulger, the notorious Boston gang lord who was on the FBI's most wanted list for nearly two decades. Once the FBI got too cozy with him, he owned the relationship. And that's just the way it happens. Once government gets too cozy with bad guys and starts incentivizing them mm-hmm. to not be bad guys don't look at that and say, whoa, thank you so much. They look at it as another scam, and they try to take advantage of it even more. They try to get more money out of you while they're doing the same things they used to do.
All right. I'm going to play devil's advocate here. I could go either way, but I'll play devil's advocate. John, we're not talking about bad guys, quote unquote. We're talking about young men, often people who are teenagers who are still reachable. You're right. If this were, 40, 45-year-old guys who had, criminal records dating back to the 90s, that'd be one thing. But we're trying to stop these young men from turning into those guys. And part of how we do that is to break this cycle of violence, take them off the streets, show them a better way that they may, frankly, not have been exposed to through family and friends.
Well, here's what I'd say to that. There's other parts to this program as well, right? There's the mentors, former prisoners, mm-hmm. former convicts mentoring these kids. It says in some cases they've there's a quote from the article. They've coaxed inebriated teenagers, threatening violence in the city-owned cars, not for a ride to jail, but home to sleep it off. You can still do all of these things without paying them a grand a month. So I'd like to see a study where they do all of this mentoring and monitoring without paying them the bribe and see if it still works. And if it does, well, that just debunked the whole need to pay them. But I also saw that they tracked 88 kids they were tracking, or 88 men, and 84 of them hadn't fallen victim. Yeah, it says 84 of the 88 young men who participated in the program remain alive, and 4 and 5 have not been suspected in another gun crime. But I'd be curious to see how much of that is due in part to the monitoring, the fact that there were eyeballs on them constantly, and not to do with the money.
You know, that actually is a fascinating point, John, because, you know, when we hear about why people join a gang, and I've talked with a lot of law enforcement officers who, you know, been involved in gang units, and, you know, almost all of them will tell you they're looking for that sense of community. They're looking for a place of belonging. And frankly, there may be family ties. At this point, there may be multi-generational mm-hmm. family ties. But the idea that the attention of someone would matter more than the money, not even necessarily the monitoring, but the attention of, you know, you're not forgotten. Somebody actually is paying attention to you. Somebody wants to see you succeed. And it actually, you know, may have your best interest at heart in a way that you haven't been exposed to before. I wonder, you're right. I mean, how much of a difference does that make as opposed to, well, you didn't kill anybody this month, so here's $1,000.
Well, right. And if you speak to any undercover officer, agent, who's gone undercover with any organized criminal enterprise, they'll agree with what you just said and with the gang cops you've spoken to have told you. You know, there's that famous case. The book was Under and Alone. Billy Queen, he was an ATF agent. He went under with the Mongols motorcycle gang. And I've spoken to him. I read his book. I've spoken to him. And one of the biggest takeaways for me was when he said, you know, as bad as these guys were, when my mom died, no one in the ATF sent any flowers, but every one of the Mongols motorcycle members called me, came and visited me, and sent flowers to the funeral home. And he said, so there is a sense of community, and it's very easy to get wrapped up. And so I think it's due, my personal opinion, is that it's due more to that. It's due more to the attention and the monitoring than it is to the money. I'd have to agree with that.
You know, the other aspect of this that gets talked up a lot in this Washington Post story is what happens if you don't stay on the straight and narrow, right? What happens if you're the 1 in 5, not the 4 in 5,
right,
who is accused of a gun crime? Do you get to cop a plea deal again? You know, do you get to work the system the same way that you have before? Or are there actual consequences this time because of all of the time and investment and money that has been devoted to try to keep you on the straight and narrow? When you don't uphold your end of the bargain, what happens to you?
Well, you know, Cam, that's a great question, right? And then there could also be another reason the success rate appears so high. If I'm a bad guy, if I'm a street thug and I'm a criminal, and you're the mayor, Cam Edwards, and you implement this program and you take one of my guys off the street and you're paying him a grand a month,
mm-hmm.
I'm not going to let him back into my criminal enterprise because I don't know if he's feeding you information. He's now on your payroll. He's not on mine anymore. And so I think a lot of this has to do with a program like this creating distrust, which would lend to them being cut deals. Because I fail to believe they're just being given money and they don't have to give up any information. I don't think they'd put that in the story. They shouldn't. But I don't believe that's not happening in part. So, yeah, I think it's a very real concern. Will they be cut deals down the road, even if they do mess up, because now they become valuable for the street information they can give law enforcement?
You know, the story also kind of, more than alleged, it basically came out and said, you know, look, if these interventionists, these former gang members who are supposed to be keeping an eye on the individuals in this program, you know, if they see a kid smoking a blunt behind the wheel of a car, they're not going to say anything. You know,
right.
if they witness criminal behavior, it's not their job to say anything at all about it to anybody. Their job is to keep these individuals from killing each other. So in a way, you know, they are getting cut a break. They are being told, yeah, you know what, some of these rules don't apply to you because you are such a concern. The only thing we're really worried about is you killing someone else, right? Don't do that, and everything's gold.
Yeah, that was my takeaway from it. I mean, that's why I used the Whitey Bulger reference, because, you know, there's that famous story with him and the FBI agent who subsequently got jammed up. He said, hey, Whitey, look, do whatever you want, just don't kill anybody. You know, and it seems that way in this case, that as long as they're not committing armed robberies with guns, violent assaults, or murder, everything else they're being given a pass on, and $1,000 a month. It's just a recipe for disaster, in my opinion.
So expanding this from a city like Richmond, California, population 100,000, with a very concentrated number of violent criminals, to a place like Washington, D.C., what would that do for the city, John? What do you think would happen?
I think it's undoable, right? And luckily, it appears, anyway, from the WAPO story, that cooler heads and logic is prevailing in D.C. for once. The mayor and the police chief seem against the program. They don't feel there's enough research. They're not budgeting for it. But I don't think in a city like D.C. you could control the outcome as much as you could in a small town like Richmond. And I think, first of all, you'd find some of these kids dead because the gangs in D.C. would think they've become informants. And I think the rest of them would just scam the system. They would take the money, and they would continue to do what they were doing. They might even play it both ways, right? They might even be giving info back up to their drug gangs about the program, about the former gang members who are mentoring in the program, and those guys will either wind up dead or corrupted. So I just don't think you could implement something like this in a large city where you have gangs that you can't control. There are a lot more bad guys out there than there are cops.
Absolutely there are. And, you know, and it should be noted, there are only about 2.5 million gang members in this country, according to the FBI.
Yeah.
But that's still, you know, that's almost a city the size of Chicago, where we've seen so much violence this year. You know, and it also strikes me that as we're talking about this, that one of the other concerns here is that the city has a vested interest in the success of the program too, as well, right? And I would worry about, we already see stories, John, about cities kind of fudging the crime numbers, reclassifying index crime so they're non-index crime, so they drop in crime appears bigger. I'd be really concerned about what would happen to try to make a program like this look successful.
Well, that's the thing. We know that they play games with CompStat. We know that they will, you know, take an armed robbery and make it a petty larceny. There's an old saying in law enforcement: the only thing you can't hide are bodies. What it means is you can fudge every other crime stat but murder. And that really,
and as it turns out, you can
earlier.
Even do that, you know, based on what we've seen where,
to an extent, sure.
You know, found body, undetermined cause of death. I mean, that can be done
good point. But you still have to report the body.
Right.
So it's still a homicide on the books. That they don't want to have. But all the other stuff, very, very easy. Very easy to make a robbery and assault or a disorderly conduct or a petty larceny. Very easy to make a rape, a harassment. It's scarily too easy in many cases.
You know, what does concern me, though, is that there's almost this simplicity to the argument, which doesn't necessarily make it a good one. But I can hear somebody saying, John, you know, look, we've tried to arrest our way out of this problem. And we've spent how many tens of thousands of dollars a year incarcerating people behind bars? If we could get the same result, less violent crime, these people are not committing violent crimes, but they're out on the street, and we're only paying them $12,000 a year as opposed to the, you know, $75,000 or $80,000 it costs to keep behind bars, why wouldn't you take that bargain?
Oh, because you're not going to get any value for your dollar, right? I mean, like when you're doing this for 84 people, 80 people, you can monitor them. Not to be redundant.
Right.
When you have to now go into a city like New York or D.C. and do it for 8,800, number one, it's cost prohibitive. Number two, the monitoring becomes impossible. You threw a really solid number out. 2 million gang members in the U.S. Versus 680,000 law enforcement people in every agency, even the agencies that have nothing to do with gang interdiction. And so when you look at gang cops, it's probably against that 2.2 million, maybe you have 25,000 gang cops in the U.S. I mean, it's like 100 to 1. Best case.
See, this is why I love having you on the program. I learn stuff from you, John. This is good. So to that end, let's kind of switch gears a little bit here. Hillary Clinton had an op-ed in the New York Daily News over the weekend. And in it, she basically said, listen, I'm going to do three things that are going to reduce violent crime. First, you say we need to repeal the law that gives the gun industry sweeping liability protections. Second, we need comprehensive background checks. Third, she says we need to close the so-called Charleston loophole. Not one of the three things that she said is actually geared towards the person who commits the violent crime.
No, none of it. None of it. It's mind-blowing to me. But this is a woman who immediately after the Brussels attack tweeted out the phrase radical jihadism, as if there is jihadism in Catholicism, evangelicalism, Judaism, Buddhism. She refuses to identify the bad guys and do something about them. This is a woman who will spend her entire all of her remaining days obfuscating the true cause of crime and going after whatever is the most progressively a political point she can. In this case, obviously, the guns. We both know that'll do nothing to reduce crime, but she'll go after them, and she knows it as well, which makes it even worse.
Yeah, that's why I said I think if you go to these neighborhoods in Chicago hard hit by violence, and you ask people, so you think another round of gun control laws is going to do the trick, I think you'd be laughed out of the neighborhood, John. I mean,
They do laugh. Yeah. No, they laugh. I mean, when we used to lock guys up in the Bronx and say, well, let me guess, you bought it at a gun shop. And they would just giggle and laugh handcuffed in the back of the patrol car. They know it's a joke. The bad guys know the reality of the streets. It's people like Hillary Clinton. But look, think about the liberal politicians. I just read something as I was on hold waiting to chat with you. Bill de Blasio has outlawed, he's signing a bill to ban chewing tobacco in sports stadiums in New York, including for the players. So now baseball players can no longer chew tobacco in New York City. This is what they're focused on. Not the rising crime rates, not the city going back to 1980s levels of crime and quality of life problems. He's worried about multimillionaire baseball players chewing tobacco during their games.
God. Oh, and this is what really scares me, John. This is what really scares me, because it seems like, you know, look, if this is the priority, if this is your priority, you're interested in policing people's tobacco products. Right? I mean, you know, we have much bigger fish to fry. And unfortunately, unfortunately, we don't have the real desire. We want to wring our hands. We want to try to exploit, the violence in places like Chicago for political advantage, to promote, gun control. But for God's sakes, John, I mean, how many decades have we been hearing this? And these neighborhoods, many of these neighborhoods are the same neighborhoods that have had violent crime persisting for decades. You know,
right.
What is the, before we let you go, because I know we're running out of time, and I appreciate you sticking around a little bit longer, but, you know, you look at a situation like Chicago, you've got so many problems, structural problems sort of baked into the cake. You got a mayor who is wildly unpopular right now. You've got a police who are concerned that every time they get out of their car, they're being, taped by 15 yeah. people with their smartphones. They've got more paperwork to do every time they make an investigatory stop right now. And you've got a lot of distrust between law enforcement and the community and a lot of damage there. I mean, how do you start to the idea that, well, you know, another gun control law, that'll do the fix. I mean, that is, as you say, it's laughable. But how do you start to turn things around? How do you start to fix it?
First, you have to start calling the problem what it is and not worry about nonsense like being called a racist or an elitist. We know that the problem happens predominantly among young African-American men, and it's epidemic level. And so we have to start looking at why that happens. We know it's a deterioration, a breakdown in the family. Once you identify that, where it's been implemented and where it's worked well, programs like the police athletic and things of that nature do help get these kids off the street. But the most successful ones are often the ones that are private, that are done by the police on their own time or done by private charities. Now, in cities like New York and in Chicago, of course, the progressives want government to do everything. Well, government never actually gets around to doing it. And so you've got these obstacles that government puts in place. But once you can identify the root and you can help get that 7-year-old off the streets so that when he's 12, 13, 14, he doesn't become a gangbanger, now you're making a dent in the problem. And if the cops are the ones mentoring and coaching these kids grow up a little bit more trustful of the police. They might have the cell phone number of that cop they trust. So if they do get in a jam, they're not going to grab a gun or run. They're going to call that cop they know on the cell phone. he might give a call to the detective who called the kid and say, hey, I know this kid is a good kid, let me come along. That prevents a lot of bad things from happening. But again, it works, and progressive politicians inevitably get in the way of it.
You know, it's interesting. Last week, Lois Beckett at The Guardian had a story about Chicago. I think you've talked with Lois on Twitter before. And it was interesting because she talked about there being, you know, she went to Chicago. She interviewed people in these neighborhoods in the South Side. And she said the number one complaint, John, is that the policing is not aggressive enough. And the,
yep.
Which is closely followed by the number two complaint of the policing is too aggressive. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is, I think, the it's not the problem of police, but is a problem for police is you've got, you know, look, you've got a big difference of opinion within the community itself as to what law enforcement should be doing.
Yeah.
So how do
you had it for years.
Right. And as law enforcement, how do you navigate that tension where some people say, listen, you're being too heavy handed and others are saying, why aren't you over here in these neighborhoods where it's really bad, where we don't see you over here? We want to see you here 6-7 times a day.
You've got to default to the law, right? You've got to default to law and order. In that case, we had it happen in New York in the 90s. Giuliani, though, wasn't afraid. I've got many issues with Rudy Giuliani. He was not very pro-Second Amendment. He was liberal in many regards. But where he excelled, he never caved to political correctness, and he allowed his cops to defer on the side of law and order, and things got a lot better very quickly.
Talking again with John Cardillo, host of The John Cardillo Show. John, listen, we've got to run, but I do appreciate you coming on the program. It is always a pleasure talking with you. And unfortunately, I have a feeling that this year, I mean, they're talking in Chicago, like it's going to, we're seeing the tip of the iceberg here. So I have a feeling that we're going to be talking with you a lot this year about what's going
on. Yeah, vice versa, too. I need you to come back on soon because I've got a bunch of Second Amendment stuff I need to discuss with you.
Absolutely. Happy to do it anytime, John. Thank you, sir.
Thanks as always, Cam. Take care.
John Cardillo, host of The John Cardillo Show here on NRA News, Cam and Company. You know, going back to this Hillary Clinton op-ed in the New York Daily News. She said, last November, I met with a group of mothers from across the country who have lived this nightmare. Moms of children like Jordan Davis from Jacksonville, Florida, who was 17 when he died. Trayvon Martin from Sanford, Florida, also 17. And Adia Pendleton from Chicago, just 15 when she was killed. They were just doing what kids do. Playing music, walking home from the store, talking with friends in the park in broad daylight, and they all ended up shot to death. At the very moment I was speaking with these mothers, she said, not far away, a 9-year-old boy named Tyshawn Lee was executed in an alley, shot 6 times on his way to visit his grandmother. Sirens blared, headlines flashed, and another life was taken too soon. Pivot! An average of 90 people a day are killed by gun violence in the United States. Hillary Clinton was the very next sentence. I mean, that was all she had to say about Tyshawn Lee. We've talked a lot more about Tyshawn Lee on this program. We've talked about the man accused of his murder. The man accused of executing this 9-year-old child because of a gang feud with Tyshawn Lee's father. We've also talked about Tyshawn Lee's father, who is part of this continuing gang feud, who was recently arrested for shooting the girlfriend of the guy who is accused of shooting Tyshawn Lee. None of that came up in Hillary's op-ed. Blame the gun manufacturers. Blame the gun lobby. Blame the gun sellers. But the people who, again, the 6% of the population of the city of Chicago that are responsible for and victimized by members of that 6%, Hillary Clinton didn't say a word about them. Didn't say a word. Apparently the way, though, to make life safer for those folks is to target the people who are not committing violent crimes, to target the legal gun owners. I got to tell you again, I mean, this is, it makes me, you know what, for a calm, steady voice, I shouldn't get angry about stuff like this, but this does make me a little angry. I don't talk about this much. I know we're going to take a break, but you know, if you're a regular listener to this program, you know, my wife lived in Camden, New Jersey for almost a decade, single mom. My oldest son was home for Easter weekend. My oldest kids very easily could have ended up like Tyshawn Lee. Camden, New Jersey was the murder capital of the United States through much of the time that my wife lived there. Thank God they did not. But they easily could have. And you know what? Camden, New Jersey had some of the strictest gun control laws in the country, just like Chicago. And those strict gun control laws prevented people like my wife from legally owning a firearm, but they didn't do a damn thing to stop the gang members from causing terror and havoc in the community. So I do get a little frustrated when I see the complete and utter inability or unwillingness, as John said, to actually confront the problem. All right, we're going to take a quick time out. When we come back, we've got more of the day's top Second Amendment news and information for you. Staff Sergeant Brian Mast, U.S. Army retired, a bomb tech with the Joint Special Operations Command, an Afghanistan vet, going to join us. We're going to talk about the explosives used in Brussels and why Brian Mast is a little concerned about what it might mean for us here in the United States. Stick around. We've got more NRA News Cam and Company sponsored by Nosler coming up right after this.
I'm speaking with David Agata and Ron Sasaki with AmericanSnipers.org. Gentlemen, welcome to NRA News.
Thanks. Thanks for having us.
Tell me, what is AmericanSnipers.org all about?
We're a nonprofit, totally volunteer. Nobody makes any money. But basically what we do is we raise money, we buy gear, and we send it to military snipers overseas to do the business that needs to be done.
And how did you start this?
In 2002-2003, we're basically police snipers from around the country. There's a big, I guess, the community's very tight, but there's a wide spread of us. And a couple of us were being deployed as reservists and National Guard as snipers. They were also police snipers, and they needed gear that they didn't have available. So we put that together, started this little project, raised a little bit of money, and then realized there was a big need. And that was 2003. We've since grown legs, and here we are 14 years later, still raising money, sending gear to snipers in country.
So, Ron, going from where you guys started in 2003 to now, what's the trip been like? How has it grown? What's happened?
Well, it's been quite an adventure for us, but a lot of the needs have not really changed. The sniper units only have so much money, so once that money runs out, the guys are doing without. So we're still providing things, mostly sniper-specific gear, like rangefinders, spotting scopes, rifle scopes, gun cleaning gear, binoculars, that kind of thing. And it's the type of gear, like Dave said, when guys are getting deployed, they would call back home and they're asking mom and dad, hey, can you pick me up a wind meter? Well, folks don't generally know where to get that kind of stuff, but we do. So that's why they come to us, and we're able to get them their specific gear that they need.
Speaking with David Agata and Ron Sasaki with AmericanSnipers.org. All right, so you guys start this. It's a no-brainer to me. It's a great idea and a great service you're all doing. What's the reaction rolling this out in the sniper community?
When people know what we're doing, all they want to do is help. And where they can help us is we raise money. We sell swag. We sell coins and little trinkets. People give and donate. The manufacturers will donate, but for the most part, people hear about it and they go, that's awesome. I'm upset we have to do that, but yeah, we want to help them.
Yeah, and it's funny you mentioned that, David. Ron, what do you guys think about, and I want to get political, but what do you think about that? It's got to be frustrating to officers to know that sometimes they can't get the support they need to get the equipment that they need.
I don't think that's ever going to change. I think as long as we have a bureaucracy that has budgets and budgets get tight, we're not going to always be able to get the things we need. We know that as police officers. We know that as the military, there's priorities. And the bottom line is, as American citizens, we're going to support our military. And when people recognize that and we can broad stroke share that, they want to be part of that.
That's cool. Once again, speaking with David Agata and Ron Sasaki with AmericanSnipers.org, you know, there's a lot of folks who don't understand what it is, the mindset, the mentality, the life of a sniper, whether it's a military or police. Ron, what can you tell people about, how can they understand best what you guys are, what you go through, you know, help get inside your head?
Well, it's just a very specialized thing that we do. It's something that people volunteer for, but you also have to have the right mindset and the determination and the professionalism to go through that. It's not for everybody, and not everybody gets to do it. But it's a very special thing, and guys who earn that spot, we try and help them out by doing what we do.
All right, it's a big sacrifice. Normally, military police, you're sacrificing.
Right, so give us an idea of some of the people that you've helped and who have benefited from AmericanSnipers.org.
Without naming names, it's been hundreds of guys in all different branches of the service. So we're at events like this. We get approached by people and said, hey, in 2004, you sent us a bunch of gear. You really helped us out. We hear from parents. So that's what we get out of it. That's what we find fulfilling.
Gentlemen, I bet you that never gets old either, right?
No,
not at all.
Not at all. And then some of the gear that we get or we get donated, we get to give that back to the manufacturers. We had a company that donated some knives.
Tell folks how they get more information about AmericanSnipers.org.
Well, you can go to our website at www.AmericanSnipers.org, and that's where they can donate. We always have gun raffles going on constantly of some pretty high-end guns that we get donated to us.
David, Ron, thanks for what you do, and thanks for being part of NRA News.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Staff Sergeant Brian Mass, U.S. Army retired, going to join us next hour, talking about the Brussels bombings. Also, Jim Wallace of the Gun Owners Action League with the latest on what is going on in Massachusetts. The proposed gun ban there in Lexington, Massachusetts, has apparently been shelved at the town hall meeting or the town meeting. They're going to have a non-binding resolution, apparently, calling for the legislature there in Massachusetts and Congress to ban all kinds of commonly owned firearms. But we'll not be talking with Jim about that. There's actually something else going on in the state of Massachusetts, because there's always something going on in the state of Massachusetts. We also have news out of California, where some pro-gun bills are actually expected to get a hearing in Sacramento tomorrow. Yeah, believe it or not, the Assembly Committee on Public Safety is scheduled to hear two pro-gun bills, Assembly Bill 2340, Assembly Bill 2508. Assembly Bill 2340 would exempt a person holding a valid license to carry a concealed firearm and who is also protected by a domestic violence protective order from both the school zone and university concealed carry prohibitions. So a concealed carry holder who is also the subject of a domestic violence protective order would be able to carry in those school zones and on a university campus. AB 2508 would allow handguns that match the original intent of the roster of handguns certified for sale to be reconsidered for the roster. This would address a real issue in California, because as handguns models, you know, may make a design change, there are, if they're on the roster of handguns that have been approved, roster of handguns certified for sale, any sort of design change, no matter how minor or inconsequential it might be, the state of California says we have to resubmit that firearm for inclusion, and they're not certifying any new handguns. So the number of handguns that are on that roster of handguns certified for sale is dwindling, even though they're actually the same gun that has been on the roster. But they're dropping off because the state of California doesn't see it that way. So this would, again, say it makes the law match the intent here. Which could make it quite a controversial measure in the California State Assembly. AB, because, again, you've got people who would love to use this roster. They're happy with the number of handguns that are available for sale in California to be dropping. They're fine with that. So expect a lot of opposition to AB 2508. Make sure if you're a California gun owner that you have talked with your assembly member and let them know what you think about both AB 2340 and AB 2558. Also tomorrow, the State Assembly on Environmental Safety and Toxic Materials is scheduled to hear Assembly Bill 1776, This is a measure that would state, clarify that the disposal of hazardous waste does not include the on-site movement of soil at an active outdoor shooting range if this movement is done to facilitate the removal and recycling of spent ammunition materials existing on the site as a result of the normal use of the shooting range and the residual soil is replaced within the area from which it was originally removed. Yeah, I know you wouldn't think that you'd actually have to have legislation to do this, but this is California that we're talking about, and so yes. Yes, you do. The bill would allow organizations to use federal best practices regarding lead recycling at training facilities without conflicting with state law. That would be another good thing. But again, if you are one of those quote-unquote gun safety advocates who are actually opposed to things like ranges where people can get trained up on being a safe and responsible gun owner, you might object to this measure too. So again, make sure that your lawmakers have heard from you in California. All right, stick around. Hour two of NRA News, Cam and Company, is coming up right after this, talking again with Jim Wallace in Massachusetts and U.S. Army retired Staff Sergeant Brian Mast, a former bomb tech with Joint Special Operations Command. All coming up in the next 60 minutes. We'll be right back with more NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by NOSDA, right after this.
Dana Lash, all the introduction to you. Good to see you, my friend.
That's good to see you.
You know, we've of course talked to you about your fabulous book, Hands Off My Gun.
Yeah, you guys have been so kind to me about this book, too, so thank you so much for that.
Talk about this for people who hadn't heard about it and who haven't read it, who haven't bought it yet. What is in this book that that should make them buy the book?
Well, there are a lot of people on Facebook, and they argue with really uneducated people who, God bless them, they've been able to defy the evolutionary process and pick their knuckles up off the ground and peter out little arguments against Second Amendment rights. But what this book does is it shuts everybody up, all those annoying people that you want to argue with on the internet. Everything that you've ever wanted to know to shut them up is in here.
Yeah.
That's like my elevator pitch. Everything that you've ever wanted to know about criminal statistics, about how the Second Amendment was created, what the founding fathers intended, even how long the Second Amendment was debated,
right,
where it came from, goes back to Magna Carta, everything. Everything is in this book. Everything. Literally everything.
You know, yesterday you had Rick Perry on and we grabbed him after you were done. You moved from Missouri to Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Now you have Governor Abbott, who's a phenomenal
good
governor
friend
himself. When you look at him as a governor, and you look at even just the tweets and the,
right,
just the tweaking he does and the, what he's done for the state. And then you look at a governor like Cuomo or a Governor Brown, and people talk about people moving to Texas in droves. And even just the governor's Twitter account shows why people on our side of the aisle are just getting U-Hauls like crazy, like you, and getting the hell out of where they are and going down to where you are.
I would say something so politically incorrect in comparison between Greg Abbott and Cuomo, but I'm trying to get right with the Lord. It's the new year. So, you know, I'm going to keep it nice.
Yes.
But probably everybody knows what I was going to say anyway. I think you can kind of get it. No, Texas is great. I mean, in St. Louis, it sucked. I mean, it was strictly becoming, very quickly becoming strictly an anti-Second Amendment town.
Yeah.
Even though the crime rate was sky high, the mayor and the police chief and everybody, you know, they really wanted to, they wanted to infringe on your rights. All my family are from the Ozarks. They're from Southern Missouri. We don't want any business with KC or STL. They just want to do them. You know, just leave us the hell alone.
Right.
And quickly, Missouri is becoming dominated by St. Louis, Kansas City, and then we have our very liberal governor, Jay Nixon. Mm-hmm. I could talk forever about
him.
That's
a whole show.
And when we moved, because we, you know, not a lot of people in St. Louis, there are not a lot of conservatives in the city, you know, or in the county. Not a lot of people liked us there. And we had people coming to our house, people giving us crap. When we moved to Texas, I don't know if you've seen The Burbs with Tom Hanks, but we were sort of like the Klopex for a little bit. Because we didn't know, people were nice to us, and we did not know how to react to that.
Right.
Like, we were so used to people just, like, screaming at us randomly if we would go out to eat.
Yeah.
And so, like, the very first time there was a neighbor that parked their car in front of my house, and I went into immediate, I mean, I've taken situational awareness classes, surveillance detection. I immediately went into my perimeter check mode, circled the car, got the plates, ran the plates, you know, and our neighbor, who knows, you know, everybody on our street's conservative. There's like more firepower on my street alone than in the entire city of St. Louis. criminals in St. Louis included.
Yes.
And my neighbors came over, and they're like, no, it's just our son. It's just our son. Right, he's right, home from college, and that's just his car. And I was like, I'm sorry. You guys are nice. I don't know how to deal with you. And that's kind of what it was. I mean, people smile at you. And I would go into, like, the grocery store, especially now that we have open carry.
Yep.
What? I love the fact that I don't
but
have
you don't
to get excited.
Go to ATV, right?
Hell no. I don't go to any place where they're like, I'm sorry, we would like for you to become a victim before you can come and buy our groceries. Ew, no, I'm not going to do that.
Welcome back. Hour two of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. Cam Edwards, your host, Staff Sergeant Brian Mast, U.S. Army retired, coming up later on in the hour. Jim Wallace of the Gun Owners Action League in Massachusetts will join us as well. And we begin this hour with some breaking news in Washington, D.C., reports of a lockdown at the U.S. Capitol after reports of shots fired at the Capitol Visitors Center. AP Mark Knoller of CBS reporting that the White House is on lockdown as well, apparently as a result of those reports there at the Capitol complex. Ellison Barber of WUSA in Washington, D.C., reporting a Capitol police source as saying that the shooter is down, but we don't have any confirmation other than a WUSA in that report. We'll keep our eyes on this breaking story and give you more details as they become available throughout the afternoon here. You know, we're going to be talking with Staff Sergeant Brian Mast of the U.S. Army retired about the attacks in Brussels, Belgium, and the explosives that were used there and his concerns about our security here at home. We also saw over the weekend in Pakistan at least 70 individuals killed, at least 300 individuals wounded, Christians who were celebrating Easter, when instead they were the targets of a suicide bombing. The attacks, again, on innocent civilians, whether it's occurring in Asia or in Europe or in North America or South America, again, there is no place that is free of this type of violence. But there is every concern that the world is seeing more of this type of violence. And, again, we're going to talk with Staff Sergeant Brian Mast coming up a little bit later on in the hour, specifically about his concerns regarding the types of explosives that were used and what our security response needs to be. You know, I can tell you, again, there are some fairly sophisticated explosives that terrorists can use that are very difficult for our both technology and human intelligence and, you know, dog sniffing or, you know, bomb sniffing dogs, very hard for them to detect. This is a constant arms race between those who are looking for new ways to destroy innocent human life and those who are looking for ways to protect it. And in some regards, I think that, you know, there's some real concern that we're falling behind in this arms race. And we'll talk about that with Brian Mast as well. Meanwhile, Pakistan's response to the bombing in Lahore is to crack down. Reuters says that the country will launch a paramilitary crackdown on Islamist militants in Punjab, the country's richest and most populous province, after the Easter Day bombing that killed 70 people. Sunday's suicide bombing on a public park claimed by Pakistani Taliban's Jamaat-ur-Ahrar faction, which once declared loyalty to Islamic State. The group said it was targeting Christians. The brutality of the attack, the fifth bombing since December by the group, reflects the movement's attempts to raise its profile among Pakistan's increasingly fractured Islamist militants. At least 29 children murdered in the attack. Security and government officials told Reuters that the decision had been made to launch a full-scale paramilitary Rangers operation, giving them powers to conduct raids and interrogate suspects in the same way as they have been in the southern city of Karachi for more than 2 years. The move represents the civilian government once again granting special powers to the military in order to fight Islamist militants. One senior security official speaking on the condition of anonymity said the technicalities are yet to be worked out. There are some legal issues also with bringing in Rangers, but the military and government are on the same page. Reuters says while it mostly focuses attacks in its base of the northwestern Momon tribal area, this group, Jamaat-ur-Ahrar, has previously carried out at least two major attacks in Lahore, one in 2015 that targeted two Christian churches, and another at the Wagah border between India and Pakistan in late 2014. Security forces have killed and arrested hundreds of suspected militants under an earlier crackdown launched after the 2014 Peshawar school massacre. Do you remember that? And again, it's only been a couple of years, but you remember that attack, right, at the school in Pakistan, targeting the children of a lot of government officials. Militant violence eased, Reuters says, but groups retain the ability to launch devastating attacks. Most militants, like the Pakistani Taliban, are fighting to topple the government and to introduce a strict interpretation of Islamic law, according to Reuters. So you can have different groups with different names and different end goals, although the end goal, I think, is largely the same, for them to be in charge, operating under a umbrella ideology. And one of the things that we'll talk about with Staff Sergeant Brian Mast here in a few minutes is, in fact, that ideology. You know, in Brussels, the death toll has climbed to 35, with more than 300 wounded. And there is grave concern about future attacks because of the number of individuals from Belgium who have traveled to Syria and Iraq to fight with ISIS who have since returned. About, estimated to be about 500. Just from Belgium. The New York Times had a story earlier today. I think it was the LA Times. Maybe it was the New York Times. Maybe it was the LA Times. Of a guy suspected. They called him Father Christmas there in Brussels because of his big bushy beard. But he was believed to be one of the big recruiters for ISIS in the area. And the story talked about how it wasn't really taken all that seriously for quite some time. But apparently it was very effective at getting these young individuals to leave their homes, to travel to Syria, to Iraq, to swear their lives in service and in submission to the cause. He is now apparently doing a 12-year sentence for his recruiting efforts, which means that he could be coming back at some point soon. You know, we've also seen this as well, not just the number of individuals who have returned from fighting, but those who have gotten relative slaps on the wrist for going and joining ISIS in the first place. You know, here in the United States, we see stories of individuals who are facing 15, 20 years behind bars for trying to go. But in Belgium, you can find stories of individuals who've gone and who fought and who've returned, who got probation for going, who still swear allegiance to ISIS. Again, these problems are not going away. And we'll talk, looking forward to talking with the Staff Sergeant Brian Mast later in the hour about his expertise, what we need to be doing here at home to protect ourselves, try to protect ourselves against these types of attacks. Now, we are still, again, watching and paying attention to the news out of D.C. We'll give you any new updates when they become available. But I'm also looking at a story here from Los Angeles, California. It was Friday night in L.A. East Century Boulevard, South San Pedro Street, just before midnight. Three suspects tried to rob a taco stand there in L.A. And KABC is reporting that a taco stand employee fatally shot one of the three suspects there in that botched robbery attempt. Suspect transported to Harbor UCLA Medical Center, where he later died. His name was withheld pending notification of next of kin. The other two suspects fled on foot, remained at large, according to police. The employee was taken into custody, cooperated with officers in the investigation, according to KABC. It said no other information available immediately. This is one of those stories that we're going to be keeping an eye on very closely. You know, again, in Los Angeles, it is highly unlikely that the owner of this taco stand had a concealed carry license for that firearm. He may very well have been a legal gun owner, but he may not have had a concealed carry license. Or it is also possible, I suppose, that the taco stand owner actually lives outside of Los Angeles County and perhaps lives in a county where you can get a license because self-defense is a human right and you have that constitutional right to keep and bear arms. But in Los Angeles County, you really don't have that right, or at least that right is not recognized. Self-defense is not seen as a valid reason to obtain a concealed carry license. That's what armed guards are for, apparently. So I'm curious to see the details of this story here and whether or not the district attorney's office in Los Angeles, which has been very intent on pushing for new ordinances aimed, again, primarily at law-abiding gun owners, regarding the storage of firearms, regarding the size of magazines that are allowed to be possessed in the city of Los Angeles. Remember, the new purchase of magazines over 10 rounds has been banned by the state of California for years now, but there are still Californians who have those magazines in their possession from before the ban was enacted. The city of Los Angeles recently told them, you can't have those anymore. Not only can you not buy new ones, you can't have the ones that you have. You got to do something with them. You got to either get rid of them. You could sell them, I suppose, but no gun store in Los Angeles County is going to want them because they can't sell them. Or you could hand them over to us. We'll be happy to take them off your hands and we'll destroy them. Nobody did that. Like, nobody did that. Not one person handed a magazine over to a member of the LAPD. But the possession of those magazines now banned under the city law. So will the prosecutor here be as zealous? Again, we don't know the facts of this case, but will the prosecutor, DA in Los Angeles, be intent on going after the taco truck driver, even if the food stand operator was acting in self-defense? Maybe if he didn't have his concealed carry license, will we go after the gun owner there, even if they were acting in self-defense? It doesn't always happen that way. Even in Chicago, and this was before Chicago's concealed carry law came into effect, you had a case of an individual who was, I believe, a convicted felon. His felony was like 30 years old, and he was in his 70s, in illegal possession of a firearm, used it in self-defense against somebody inside of his own home, and there was such outpouring of support for the individual by his neighbors and within the community, that they decided not to prosecute. Again, that was Chicago. Whereas I said, if you talk to people in these neighborhoods hit hardest by violence, they will ask them what they think of the need for more gun control laws, and you'll get a good chuckle out of them. But you won't get a whole lot of serious support for those measures. Because, again, you live in one of these neighborhoods that has been wrestling with the consequences of these violent individuals for decades. And the number of times that a politician has said, you know, if we just had this law in the books, I mean, you try to start counting on one hand, you got to move down to your toes. You got to borrow your neighbor's hands and toes to count the number of times that an elected official or somebody who wants to be an elected official has said, if we just pass this law, if we just do this. And in the meantime, the violent criminals, the people who are making life so miserable for the good people in these beleaguered communities, you know, it doesn't really seem to matter what laws are on the books, because their charges always get plea bargained down anyway. So they say we need another law that doesn't get enforced, not against the violent criminal. The armed robbery charge gets pleaded down to simple robbery. The felon in possession charge gets dropped. With credit for time served, these individuals soon back out on the streets, and again with very little consequences beyond the life and death consequences for their actions, but without any consequences from the legal system, they go right back to it. It is a quite literally a vicious cycle. And the idea that another round of legislation aimed at the people who aren't committing these violent crimes would be the answer and the panacea, it's just absurd. All right, we're going to take a quick timeout. Staff Sergeant Brian Mass going to join us here after a quick timeout. Jim Wallace of the Gun Owners Action League in Massachusetts. We will also give you an update on what's going on in Washington, D.C. The Associated Press reporting Capitol officials say that one Capitol police officer was shot, not seriously. A shooter is in custody. But we will again try to give you a confirmation of that and give you more details about what's going on in our nation's capital as the afternoon goes on. So stick around. We've got much more. NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up next.
I'm speaking with Chris Midget, with the Firearms Guide. Chris, you've got a really exciting, neat product. Tell folks, what is the Firearms Guide?
Firearms Guide is a huge firearms, airguns, and ammunition searchable guide or a reference guide that it's online. Web address is firearmsguide.com. It's a subscription-only website, but it's not only a website. It's a huge searchable firearms and ammunition reference guide that it has its own search engine built inside of it, so all the users can actually search all these guns by the 14 different search criteria, by caliber, by country of origin, by year of production, by the type of the gun. Do I want to check rifle or a shotgun? Do I want to check semi-automatic shotgun, over and under shotgun, side-by-side shotgun, or maybe lever-action shotgun?
Wow, that's impressive. So So how did this come about? It sounds like a really neat resource to have.
Yes, we've been developing this for over 8 years. We published 5 previous editions on DVDs, and this 6th newest edition will not be published on DVD. We actually just publish it online in the form of searchable database.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So who's the kind of person, Chris, that would use the Firearms Guide? Give me a typical customer.
You know what? Typical customer is any gun enthusiast. Let me say that you're looking for a new concealed carry pistol. How are you going to find? You cannot Google these things. You cannot put in a Google, please show me concealed carry pistol. You press search and you get 65,000 websites. With us, you go to Firearms Guide. First click, you click on the handguns. Then you choose caliber. For example, let me say 380. Then after that, you choose barrel length, because barrel length is
right.
Also one of the search criteria. So you choose something small, like 3-inch barrel length.
Right.
You want your concealed carry pistol to be light. So you choose frame material instead of steel. Let me say, let it be polymer.
All right, before we run out of time, how do you get more information about it?
Please go to firearmsguide.com. Everything is there.
Firearmsguide.com. Thanks, Chris. Thanks for being on NRE News.
Thank you very much. Keep good work.
Speaking with Dan Caporelli with Hire Our Heroes. Dan, welcome to NRA News. Tell us, what is Hire Our Heroes?
Yeah, so Hire Our Heroes is a nonprofit organization that basically helps transitioning veterans to position themselves for employment as they get out of the service.
Why'd you start this, Dan?
I served in the Marine Corps Reserves, and after 8 years, I got out thinking I had this great skill set. I was a satellite communications specialist, and shortly thereafter, long story short, there was really no opportunity for me to really find employment or anybody to help me find employment. So I felt like I was on an island by myself, and I thought if hey, I couldn't be the only veteran going through this, that there was probably a need for a greater reach. And lo and behold, I gathered a few other veterans, and we formed Hire Our Heroes, basically founded by veterans for veterans.
That is great. So what's the reaction been to Hire Our Heroes?
You know, it's been phenomenal. It's one of those things, be careful what you wish for. The response has been overwhelming at times, but it has been nothing short of great and rewarding at the same time. There's nothing but opportunity for us to help veterans. And believe it or not, there's a lot of nonprofits out there, and these veterans still have a tough time really finding the right one that's going to bring them down the path to success as they transition out.
Dan
Cap- we feel like we've got a pretty cool tool set to do that.
Awesome. Dan Caprelli with Hire Our Heroes. How can folks get more information about the great work you're doing and your great organization?
Visit us on the web at hireourheroes.org, and they could fill out information on whether or not they're interested in transitioning, reaching for somebody to reach out for them to connect, as well as some of our other services and that we offer.
Dan Caprelli, thanks for what you're doing, and thanks for being on NRA News. Welcome back. Thanks again for joining us here on another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company. Jim Wallace of the Gun Owners Action League coming up later in the hour. Hero of the Day, sponsored by AdCorp Defense. Deal of the Day, good guy coming up, top of the hour as well. We are following what's going on in Washington, D.C., getting some conflicting reports, as often happens when you're in that sort of initial zone of confusion. A lot of information, a lot of sources being worked, and not all of the information is accurate, but what we know is that there were reports of shots fired at the Capitol Visitor Center. Press reports indicate that the shooter is in custody. There are some reports indicating that the shooter was shot and was taken to a local hospital by a Capitol Police officer. There are other reports that a Capitol Police officer may have been shot as well. This is where the confusion comes in. Hopefully that will be settled out here in the next couple of minutes, but thankfully it does not look like the incident involved anybody other than law enforcement and the suspect at this time. So we will continue to give you more developments as they come in. Right now, I want to welcome to the program Staff Sergeant Brian Mass, U.S. Army, retired, with us on the program. Sergeant, thank you, sir, for your time.
No, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to talk with you. And again, thank you for your service. I know that doesn't even begin to make up for your service and your sacrifice, but I can tell you, you've got a lot of people who support what you do and support our military listen to this program.
Our country has really made me feel that way. You know, I'll tell you, there is no makeup for anything that happened on the battlefield. I don't regret a minute of my time spent there. There's never one day that goes by where I would trade two legs and a finger for the lives of any one of my friends. And I think I speak for most service members that they feel the same way.
You know, you talk about your injuries. You were a bomb tech, right, with the Joint Special Operations Command?
That's exactly right. I found one too many, as I tell people.
And so I'm guessing when you hear stories about, you know, the another suicide bombing, whether it's the bombing in Pakistan or the bombings in Brussels, Belgium, you were taking note of details in these stories that, frankly, probably a lot of lay people are not even paying attention to. We don't even know what questions to ask.
So you better believe it. Whenever there's an act of terrorism that involves an explosive device, I'm trying to look at where was it located, what was the size of device, what type of explosives were used, was this a coordinated attack, what were some of the telltale signs that we could look for to say, yeah, this could have actually been prevented, or no, there was just no possible way to ever tell that this was going to occur. These are all things that you have to look at after any attack to learn how to protect people in a better way.
So when you hear the type of explosives that were used, the TATP explosives that were believed to be used in Belgium, what does that tell you about the capabilities of IS, and how easy is that type of explosive to replicate or create here?
Well, making TATP, I'm not going to say it's the easiest thing in the world, but among homemade explosives, it's among the easier ones to make. Now, it takes a little bit of guts to do it. Whenever you're mixing up a batch of homemade explosives, you're understanding of the idea that what you're mixing up could actually blow up on you. So there's a little bit of guts that it does take to do that. But the components to make triacetone, triperoxide, that's what TATP stands for, they can be found at any basically large big box store here in the United States or here in the West. You can get every component that you need to make it, your peroxide, your acetone, your strong acid. And then beyond that, all you really need is a pretty good YouTube video to tell you how to mix it up and how to make the explosive out of it.
Yeah, okay, so how easy is it to identify, whether from, you know, bomb-sniffing dogs or human intelligence or technology, how easy is it for us to figure out that this is present?
We definitely have systems in place that can identify this. We have dogs. We have systems in place within our transportation infrastructure that very specifically looks for peroxide-based explosives. That's what TATP is. It's a peroxide-based explosive. But this is also one of the shortcomings that exists right there, is that if you say take a look at any airport, you might see a dog here or there, but you don't see an amount of dogs that would say this would really protect the entire facility from any terrorist attack of somebody having a suitcase full of 30-plus pounds of TATP or a suicide vest full of TATP. And here's one of the other things that's additionally dangerous about TATP, as you think of it in terms of a suicide vest, which this is what the Paris attackers were wearing in terms of a suicide vest. They were wearing a vest filled with TATP, that if a law enforcement officer puts a bullet in that suicide attacker in anywhere other than the head, if that bullet goes into the TATP, it is going to detonate that device, and it's going to result in the exact same explosion that terrorist wanted in the first place. And that's a major concern.
Especially if they're already willing to take their own life, right? What does it matter if they are the ones who detonate it or if law enforcement detonates it?
You better believe it. And that's the threat that we face. And when you face any one of these security checkpoints, whether you're talking about at a bus depot, at a train station, at an airport or somewhere else, what you're essentially doing is you're herding all of the victims onto one side of that checkpoint. And that's where it becomes very important that we try to implement something that has more to do with behavioral detection. And this is something that the Israelis have been very good at, is implementing behavioral detection, where maybe there would have been somebody in place that said, this is a little suspicious that there's three men here and two of those men are each wearing a single black glove. That's suspicious. Let me approach them before they get to the targeted area, and they could have potentially saved lives with the right amount of behavioral detection.
It seems like the process of putting that in place, you'd A, have to have that individual there who's looking, scanning, able to identify that, almost instantaneously. And you'd have to do it, I guess, what ideally in this situation before, as you say, before they get to their intended target. So, CCTV cameras, perhaps in the parking lot, or I guess at some point, Brian, are you concerned that you can't harden up every possible soft target out there?
That's definitely something that has to be acknowledged. There, you can't look at this as though it's this magic pill. That's a fallacy. There's not a magic pill that is all of a sudden going to make every person in every situation safe. That's not the case. It's not reality. But through behavioral detection, that is actually a very good thing that needs to be implemented at a much more robust level than what it currently is being implemented. When you have undercover individuals that are out there in the parking lot, in the drive-up area, throughout the inside of just using an airport, for example, the inside of an airport, looking for these people that are sweating, that are, you know, giving some sort of telltale sign that something is not right about them, and then they're being checked out, that is a great layer of security versus doing detection on somebody that might be a 95-year-old woman that, well, it's entirely possible she might be wielding an explosive vest. The probability that a 95-year-old woman is wielding an explosive vest, it's very unlikely, and that's one of the balances there. We have to be smart about what we're doing.
Is there, Brian, in your opinion, is there an element of security theater to what you just described, the pat-downs of the 95-year-old woman? Or, you know, we've all seen these stories. Is there
smoke and mirrors? Is there a dog and pony show that's involved in some of this? Absolutely. Nobody should be under any disguise that there's not. And it goes from the level of hiring to the level of layers of security that are being put in place. Some things in many places are simply just checking the box. You know, you can look back recently in the modern history of TSA and say, yeah, there was a number of tests that went on where there was roughly a 90% fail rate of devices that were being put through the X-ray machines. Well, that if there's that kind of fail rate, well, then to some degree, you can look at that as a dog and pony show. It's not being effective in finding the devices that are supposed to be going through there. And that's where we have another big discrepancy in the hiring of the people hired by, say, TSA, and that many of these individuals are not security professionals. You're not hiring people that just came off the battlefield that would be great security professionals in those roles. You're hiring oftentimes people that are very much at an entry-level position that maybe just came from the food service industry or somewhere else, and now they're being tasked with security. And that's not necessarily the right individual to hire. The behavioral detection officers, these should be individuals that were hired after coming out of psychological operations from the military, where they've literally looked down terrorists eye to eye on the battlefield. The canines being put in place, those should be canine handlers that have just come off the battlefield as canine handlers in the military that have real experience in finding real explosives, not people that are given these jobs as an entry-level position.
Well, you know, and maybe part of the problem here is that you're going to have you're not going to be able to use entry-level pay to attract those candidates. But it seems to me like, as you know, the person that you describe, frankly, is probably worth two or three individuals who don't have that knowledge, who don't have that background, and who don't have that situational awareness, because you're going to have to train those folks anyway.
You better believe it. Experience plays a large role in this. But where you're talking about some of these more advanced positions, the canine handler, the behavioral detection officer, they're hiring folks that just came out of entry-level security within TSA so often, but they're not giving them entry-level pay. They're putting them at a higher part on a higher position on the pay scale. And that's where it's completely realistic that they hire somebody coming out of the military to do this in the exact same quantity that they're hiring individuals that were literally, like I said, just working in food service just before that.
That is, I'm getting more and more frightened the longer I'm talking with you, Brian, honestly. I mean, what you're describing is the same sort of bureaucratic incompetence that we've come to expect from most government agencies, only now we're talking about our national and our personal security.
Well, that's exactly right. This is exactly what it is. It's another large federal government agency that unfortunately isn't always accountable to the tasks that they're supposed to be doing as much as they're accountable to the individuals that they've already hired on in trying to do something for those people. That's one of the biggest problems that we face. You know, TSA has a union within it, and that union is not necessarily looking out for the best security of the country. They're looking out for the interests of those individuals that are hired, and that doesn't necessarily equate to better security.
Talking again with Staff Sergeant Brian Mass, U.S. Army retired. Sergeant, I got to ask you, because in doing some research before you got on the program, I learned that you've got one heck of a story of going to Harvard after your injuries. And, you know, we talk on this program a lot about what's going on college campuses, the microaggressions, the safe space culture. Did you see that when you were at Harvard? And when you look at what's going on around the world today, when you talk about the bombings in Brussels, the bombings in Pakistan, the murderous ideology that is on the march around the globe, do you find the concept of a safe space on campus a little laughable? I mean, are we avoiding dealing with some of these real problems here that we face in this world?
Laughable would be an understatement. I mean, this is not who we are as a people. We are not a people that are made of glass, that we're so weak that under the slightest amount of stress or pressure that we're just going to shatter into little bits and pieces. You know, and I'm familiar with this to some degree. Like I said, I had to recover from losing two legs and a finger on the battlefield. I can tell you that, you know, recovering and facing these challenges, that is who we are as a people, that we face these things and we don't just curl up into a corner and quit, that really we own these challenges that we face and we look them in the eye and we use them as the tool that makes us the strongest that we've ever been. That's who we are as an American people. And if we lose that part of our heritage, then, you know, we're done. We're done. We're not going to be competitive anywhere in the world. I think, you know, you go back, and I could probably say one of my favorite speeches, hands down, is that of General Patton to the Third Army, where he talks about, you know, Americans, we traditionally love to fight. That's who we are as a people. And you look at the people that you respect, the best ball player, the champion boxer. These are the people that you respect. You know, General Patton, he says, I don't give a damn for somebody that loses and laughs. And that's who we've always been as a people, and who we're becoming on these college campuses, people that saying that deserve everything for free. That's not who we are. And really, it makes me sick to see us going down this road.
Well, listen, again, I appreciate the fact that we have people like you in this country who are helping to apply the brakes a little bit, and maybe even turn the ship of state around. Brian, thank you again for your time, sir. I hope that we can have you back on the program at some point.
I hope you can another time, too. I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Absolutely. Do you have a website where we can find out more about you?
You better believe it. So, as you know, I'm a candidate for Congress down here in Florida. People can check out my website, and that's mastforcongress.com.
All right. Brian Mast, thank you again, sir, and look forward to doing this again soon.
Thank you.
Brian Mast, a Staff Sergeant, U.S. Army, retired, with us here on NRA News. Cam and Company talking again about the security threats that we face, the security theater that we have. As I said, it wasn't necessarily a heartwarming conversation, but it is important that we talk about this. And again, as I was reading about Brian and the fact that after he lost his legs in Afghanistan, he went back to college, but he didn't just go back to college. While he was in the Army, he had been taking courses online and at the community college. He'd earned about 30 credits because he joined right out of high school. He decided he wanted to go back. He heard about the Harvard Extension, and he went back to school, and he went to Harvard, which, my hat's off to him. But to be there, to go from the battlefield to Harvard Square, and to be there while we have seen the rise of the snowflakes, even at Harvard, instapundit.com, Glenn Reynolds there at the University of Tennessee, had a link earlier today to a piece, I believe, in the Harvard Crimson. Yes, A Culture of Sensitivity by Rachel Huebner, who says, I used to believe that open discourse was a value all Americans hold dear. I presumed that when asked about what makes America so unique, many Americans would respond that our pluralistic society is the foundation of so much of our success, that it was understood that without a marketplace of ideas, our society simply could not flourish. But then I started college. Since the beginning of my freshman year, she writes, I have come to believe that a more fitting way to describe the current culture on college campuses is a culture defined not by open expression, but by sensitivity. This undue focus on feelings has caused the college campus to often feel like a place where one has to monitor every syllable that is uttered to ensure that it cannot under any circumstance offend anyone to the slightest degree. It sometimes feels as though pluralism has become an antiquated concept. Facts and history have been discarded, and instead feelings have been deemed to be the criteria that determine whether words and actions are acceptable. She's seen this at Harvard. The same type of sensitivity that we have seen on campuses from the University of Missouri to Western Washington University to Emory University. If there are hurt feelings, then a wrong has been committed. A redress of grievances must take place. Punishments must be meted out. And the offending words shall never be spoken again, all in the name of having a safe space. Meanwhile, again, we have people who want to murder us. And we are so busy worried about whether or not the grammar we used is the correct grammar. I say we, not all of us. But there are folks who are more concerned about these imaginary disasters in these microaggressions than they are concerned about the very real macroaggressions being perpetrated against innocents around the world. Just strikes me as bizarre. All right, Jim Wallace of the Gun Owners Action League going to join us after a quick timeout. Stick around. We have much more NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this.
You know him. You love him. Chris Ching is with us. How are you, Chris?
Hey, good morning, Cam. I'm doing fantastic.
I always want to introduce you as Tom Sonic Champion, but you're so much more than that now. I mean, it's really, your career has just taken off and expanded. I mean, you're doing a lot of different stuff right now.
Yeah, so one of the main things that I'm really excited about this year is a company called Mason Target Systems. And so I'm an investor and an advisor for the company. And essentially what our product is, it's an electronic smart target system. So imagine an AR-500 steel plate with sensors hooked up to it. You shoot the plate, your shot location shows up on your mobile device, right? Your iPad, your iPhone. Then the problem that we're trying to solve for here is, you know, imagine if you're at the range, you're shooting out at 200 yards, you got some paper target down there, you shoot, you have to then break off the gun to look through the spotting scope and trying to remember, all right, which was shot number 19 and which one was shot number 20, and
right.
You're trying to figure out, you know, where your shot location is. So trying to make that whole process of collecting your shot data, right, in the mobile app. There's a whole cloud account that you can have in Mason Target Systems, paired with a virtual gun locker. And it reduces the need for a range to go cold. Right, so no more calling the range cold to go, walk down, check and change targets. And ultimately, the technology is empowering shooters to shoot more. Right, we want the technology layer to just disappear. It's just a part. It's just something that works, and you can just keep shooting, and you can see where your shot locations are showing up on your mobile device.
That's actually really cool. And so, is this available now? Is this still in development? And where are we?
It is available today at MasonTargetSystems.com. It's something that I and the founder, Greg Mason, we have a bigger team. We've been working on it for a good 2 years plus. Getting a lot of feedback from the industry, from the military, a lot of law enforcement agencies, and we are really excited to finally pull the curtain back and do the big announcement that Mason Target Systems is here. At a very high level, you know, before I won Top Shot, I was at Google, right, working in Silicon Valley in technology. And you know, one of the great things about Google and a lot of tech products is that they're simple and easy to use, right, that from a design perspective, you can just give someone an iPhone, right, or show someone a Google, Google.com, it's just easy to use.
Right.
So if you take that design principle of something that's easy to use, right, bring that to the firearms space. How do we make technology easy to use when you're shooting guns to provide useful information and feedback around, all right, look at my groups when I'm shooting my pistol. They're all going, low to the right, low to the right, but I can capture all of that shooting data session information. And so making things easy to use for people is something that, for me, I wanted to bring to Mason Target Systems. And again, it's all about how do we make shooting more pleasurable and more useful for people who want to go shoot targets.
This is really interesting. Now, of course, there are going to be a lot of gun control advocates who are saying, Chris, why are you expending all of this time and energy on something like this? You should be working on smart gun technology. You should be working on, the biometric fingerprinting system for guns. But this is practical.
Yes.
This is something that I think is a natural evolution of technology. It seems to me like there's always going to be a market for products that help you shoot better, that help your training, that help you understand what you're doing right and what you're doing wrong.
Correct. And, this is ultimately, I think, we're listening to the market, right? We're listening to what shooters, the problems they have, the challenges they have, the range. We've been talking to, hundreds of shooters, plenty of range owners. And so, for a shooter, right, that whole back and forth of, calling the range cold, it's downtime. That's just, when you call a range cold to go walk down 200 yards to change and check targets, it's a waste of time for the shooter. It's a waste of time for the range. Or if you're a military or law enforcement agency, it's downtime, right? Like, you could save that time by using a Mason Target Systems target and putting more rounds down range because you're there to shoot. You're not there to just sit around and watch people, you know, change targets.
Right.
Or, you know, if you're taking a picture of your paper target and then, you know, transcribing that into some kind of range log, that's the kind of process we want to just remove, and your shooting data automatically, right, gets uploaded into your online profile.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. All right, we are still following what's going on in Washington, D.C. We'll give you an update here as the zone of confusion narrows. Still some conflicting information out there, but we'll give you an update here in a few minutes. Right now, I want to welcome to the program for the Gun Owners Action League in Massachusetts, our friend Jim Wallace. How are you, sir?
And welcome back to the Second Amendment Battleground State. And let me just throw in for one for a local team. You know what? Go UConn NCAA women. Awesome team.
Ah.
They're getting beat up, Cam. Believe that?
All right. That was unexpected. I was not expecting a shout-out to the UConn women's team, but okay, there you go.
Man, they beat their last opponent by 60 points. Come on. Go.
That's, That's pretty brutal. All right. Well, hopefully Second Amendment advocates and gun owners in Massachusetts can provide the same type of win here. So Lexington, Massachusetts, Jim, we've been talking about what's going on in Lexington. There was the town meeting coming up, and an individual there wanted to vote on some bylaw changes to ban semi-automatic rifles, quote-unquote assault weapons, to ban magazines over 10 rounds. Looks like that is now going to take the form of a non-binding resolution. But meanwhile, Longmeadow, Massachusetts, they've got their town meeting coming up on May the 10th, and now they're looking at some anti-gun laws.
Well, not only that, but we just got word, I believe it was last Friday, that the town of Ipswich has something on their town meeting agenda for May 10th. And so Longmeadow, from what I understand, wants to pretty much use the same so-called assault weapons language that Lexington started with. They also want to ban the possession of any gun on publicly owned land, which would include sidewalks, streets, you know, your town hall, whatever it might be. Now, Ipswich actually wants to ban the discharge of firearms, including pellet guns and air guns and BB guns on your own property, and ban hunting with firearms. So it's pretty obvious, Cam. You know, we've had the conversation about Lexington, but, you know, we're up to about 15 or 16 different communities in the last year that have gone this route. And typically we might see one a year, but this obviously has to be a very well-organized effort across the Commonwealth. And, you know, you can kind of guess on the national level who might be behind certain things, but it's pretty evident that this is a coordinated effort. And what their goal is to make a patchwork of laws within a given state that make it so difficult to be a gun owner that people will just simply give up. I don't think that's about to happen anytime soon, but that seems to be their agenda because they're a little bit different everywhere they go. So they're trying to make different laws in different towns, but make them all just as insidious, if you will.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And as you say, the uptick in what we're seeing here in Massachusetts, it kind of reminds me, Jim, a few years ago in Pennsylvania when anti-gun advocates, they went to the state house, they wanted a bill that would require gun owners to report their firearms lost or stolen within 48 hours or they become a criminal. Lawmakers said, now, this is supposedly, prosecutors are telling us they don't want this. Prosecutors want to increase penalties for straw purchasers, so that's what we're going to do. And then instead we saw the anti-gun advocates move around the state of Pennsylvania. They got several dozen of these communities to pass local ordinances requiring that firearms be reported to police if they were lost or stolen within 48 hours. This is, again, it sort of reminds me of that same concept here. If they're not getting what they want there at the state house, that they'll move to the local level, despite the fact that, again, we've seen in the coverage there regarding the Lexington Town Hall meeting, you know, one of the criticisms was, well, listen, this isn't going to be enforceable. It's going to conflict with state law. We're going to open ourselves up to a lawsuit. None of that really seems to matter, though, to the activists who are pushing these changes.
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, it's almost like they're trying to make it difficult not only for gun owners, but their own town governments. And it's kind of interesting, again, because even another one at the Long Meadow agenda was that when you renewed your license, you actually had to register all of your firearms with the local chief. Well, that's not a requirement under Massachusetts law. You don't even have to do that at the state level. So, you know, Kim, they've really lost the debate on the national level. They've pretty much lost it on the state level, even though things still kind of fly once in a great while. So their only hope is to try to get the message in at the local level where, for the most part, people don't pay attention, really, to what goes on at annual town meetings, unless there's something like a tax increase or they're building a new school. But even that only brings out certain amount of people who are interested in that.
Yep.
So they were thinking probably that they could get in a lot of these without getting any attention to them. And to their chagrin, I guess, is that luckily our members have been paying attention, and the more it happens, the more they pay attention. And they've been notifying us once they found out. And with that, we can get the word out to our members. But, you know, the old saying sometimes is, you know, we have to win 100% of the time. They only have to win once. And maybe that's their, you know, their end result. Who knows?
Well, as you say, it is good that people are becoming more aware of this because, you know, you're absolutely right, Jim. I mean, we talk about this on the program all the time. When I was a reporter covering, I rarely would have to go to City Hall, but I would have to cover a couple of different school board meetings. And I could tell you, nobody would show up, Jim. I mean, unless your kid was, you know, on the honor roll and they were going to get recognized, nobody was there. They're talking about, you know, spending tens of millions of dollars and there was no public oversight. So you're right. A lot of these town meetings, I mean, unless you know ahead of time, there's going to be something of importance or issue to you, you know, maybe easy just to tune out, say, I got something better to do that day, or, why get involved here? But if that awareness is raised, as we saw, there were hundreds of people who turned out for a Board of Selectmen, meeting in Lexington, to speak out in opposition to this proposal of the town meeting. And the local paper said the vast majority of them were from right there in Lexington, Massachusetts. I'm sure that was an eye-opening experience for the anti-gun advocates who thought that they were surrounded by like-minded folks who were more than happy to restrict the Second Amendment rights of their fellow citizens.
Well, it is. I mean, and when you go back to, I guess it was Westford over a year ago that really kind of kicked this whole thing off. And they faced the same thing. They had to actually move the meeting. I think they moved it to a high school, but I'm, you don't quote me on that. But they were amazed at how many people came out for this. So it's, you know, it's one of those things that once they light a match under that fire, word spreads and they're dealing with a civil rights issue. It's tough enough to deal with tax issues. But boy, when you start dealing with a civil rights issue, it's amazing how many people come out of the woodwork in support of us. And I think people like this gentleman in Lexington, it's almost like he still can't believe it's a reality that the vast majority of people support, you know, the Second Amendment civil rights and they're rejecting his notions. And he's almost got the attitude like, wow, I didn't realize there were so many stupid people around and they're not listening to me. So, but I guess, you know, sometimes when you hear the only thing you hear for the rest of your life is the echo of your own voice, and you never ask for other opinions, sometimes that's what you run into.
Unfortunately, you're right. Listen, Jim, before we let you go here, we're almost running out of time, but I have not talked with you since the Supreme Court's decision in the Catano case, telling the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court to go back and read Heller, that their decision banning, saying that stun guns were not constitutionally protected, was wrong in light of what they said in Heller McDonald. Obviously, that's a big decision for Massachusetts, but how big a decision do you think this is going to be there ultimately, not just in terms of stun guns, but in terms of the state of Massachusetts finally perhaps recognizing that the right to keep and bear arms is a real right?
Well, it's kind of interesting on two different levels because, well, first of all, we actually call this the SCOTUS Smackdown is the new nickname for that decision. It's the first time, and it's about time, that the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court had the smackdown from the higher court than they did, because for decades and decades, the Massachusetts highest court would not recognize Second Amendment civil rights in Massachusetts. And as we've talked about before, just a few years ago, they were still using the Cruikshank decision as their basis on the Second Amendment. So it's very important, and I've never in my career, not that I've read every Supreme Court decision, but never read a decision where the High Court unanimously just gave a smackdown to the court below them, basically chiding, you will respect our decision on Heller and McDonald. You will recognize it as a civil right. And they weren't pulling any punches on this stuff. So it's kind of interesting. The other thing is some of the discussions I've had with people on the other side of our issue is they're terrified now because they see the beginning of the end of things like the assault weapons bans, the Attorney General's regulations on handguns that were passed fraudulently, you know, the approved firearms roster, all of these things that go after things they don't like. And I actually had people ask me, oh, my Lord, if these laws get undone because of civil rights, what are we going to do? So it's kind of interesting to listen to those people and their reaction to this decision.
Well, Jim, listen, I appreciate you coming to the program, sir. Always enjoy your insight. Hope we can talk again very soon, my friend.
Absolutely. We'll talk to you later.
All right. Go UConn. Jim Wallace giving a shout-out there. Hour three of NRA News Cam and Company coming up with the hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy and more. Stick around. We'll be right back after a quick timeout.
I'm speaking with Vicki Callmaker. Vicki, you do so much. Women's Shooting Academy, 1 Million United, Safety Academy. Where do you want to start? Should we start with Women's Shooting Academy?
Absolutely. Let's start with Shooting Academy.
All right. Welcome to NRA News. What's it all about?
The Women's Shooting Academy really came to be, I thought I was just going to teach one class, right? I thought I was just going to teach women how to shoot a gun. And over the last 7 or 8 years, it's just really evolved into something that I could have never imagined. And I've trained thousands of women, and I'm just all about the art of self-preservation.
What is that? Tell me what you mean when you say the art of self-preservation.
You know, I want women to realize that they're worth protecting, their family is worth protecting, and obviously, you know, if we're going to go gun, that is the equalizer. I'd like to see every woman carrying a gun. But at the same time, I realize that a gun is not for every woman. And so it's really taking her on a journey, a personal journey, about her personal safety and getting her to realize that she can own it, she can embrace it, she can fight for it, and she can lose it.
Wow. So how do you do that at Women's Shooting Academy?
Well, our most popular class is called Introduction to Handguns. And what I do with the students is they show up, they spend about 5 or 6 hours with me in the classroom. They learn how to load and unload. They learn everything there is to know about a firearm. And part of that is teaching them the lingo so that when they end up at the gun counter, they don't sound like an idiot. And teaching them the proper way to stand, to hold the gun, really focusing on the fundamentals. Then I take them to the range, and I provide the guns, the targets, the ammunition, and they shoot 5 calibers. They shoot both revolvers and semi-automatics. And after an 8-hour day, they're ready to go to the gun counter, and they can do that alone. They can buy their first handgun by themselves. And then, you know, if they want to come back and take some additional training, absolutely. If they want to get their concealed carry permit, we can do that. They want to learn about shotguns for home defense, we can do that. I'm really excited because I'm starting to see that women want to shoot the big guns. They want to shoot the ARs. They want to shoot this fun stuff. And when they realize it's not as complicated as they thought,
right,
they're in.
There you go. Speaking with Vicki Callmaker, so let's talk about 1 Million United. What is that?
So 1 Million United actually started out to be very political. And it was my answer back to Mr. Bloomberg several years ago. Don't tell us we cannot unite. So hence 1 Million United.
Right.
But over the last year and a half, it's evolved. And what I decided to do with 1 Million United was to turn it into a 501c3 nonprofit. Because I believe that there's women across this entire country who need to hear what I had to say. And I want to offer that to them 100% no charge. I see myself on a large platform teaching safety seminars and really uniting women. And so 1 Million United will be 100% donor funded. And, you know, I got to learn how to raise money. I don't know how to raise money, but I need to raise money. And so that will allow me to just broaden my services. You know, I've got my for-profit companies. Let's do something that will benefit every woman across the country.
All right, almost out of time. How can we get more information about everything you're up to?
Go to VickiCallmaker.com, and from there you can find 1 Million United, the Women's Shooting Academy, and everything else I do.
Vicki Callmaker, thanks for what you're doing. You're doing so much. And thanks for being here on NRA News. Stay in touch with us.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome back. Hour 3 of NRA News. Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom coming up a little bit later on in the hour. Also, Tony Bernardo of the Canadian Institute for Legislative Action. On Quebec, kind of dragging its feet a little bit on this long gun registry, what appeared to be so popular back when the federal long gun registry in Canada was scrapped, now appears to be quite a bit less popular since the price tag and the costs are now being bandied about. Right now, I want to get to our hero of the day, sponsored by AdCorps Defense from KHOU in Houston, Texas. They say the police cars and tape outside of a Family Dollar store painted an all-too-familiar picture Friday morning. But this wasn't a robbery in which a clerk was shot and killed. No, in this case, the clerk fought back. A 25-year-old store clerk fatally shot a suspected robber inside the store. Have a 9:30 a.m. Friday morning. Other workers ran to the back of the store when the suspect came in. Ivan Sanchez says, I left the back room to see if he was okay, see where he was at. And when I left the back room and when I got out there, I see him with the robber, and the robber was already lying on the floor. Family member tells KHOU that the clerk had a license to carry. Clerk's uncle said the place had been robbed several times right before Thanksgiving. They robbed him, and even after he gave them everything, they still hit him with the gun. Regular customers glad to hear that the clerk wasn't hurt. Shalandra Peavy said he just smiles and says, how you doing? Very soft-spoken, so I know he's not a killer, but he is a survivor. Ivan Sanchez said, I want people to know that my coworker is an outstanding guy. KHOU says the case will be turned over to a grand jury to decide if any charges will be filed. Alice Barr of KHOU reporting that the clerk received his concealed carry license after that robbery in Thanksgiving, when he was bashed in the head after cooperating with the robber. We will keep our eyes on this story and give you more details if and when they become available. Now to our deals of the day, plural. First from Illinois, not Chicago, Skokie, Illinois, and the Skokie Patch. Jermaine Powell, he is a suspect in the death of 31-year-old Catherine Benjamin, who was found inside her home on Thursday after being strangled to death. When police made the discovery, they also found out that there was supposed to be a child there in the home. 10-month-old Joshua Powell, the son of Jermaine Powell and Catherine Benjamin, he was missing. That child later founded a church on the south side of Chicago. Witnesses say a man matching Jermaine Powell's description was seen dropping the baby off. The Skokie Pat says that Jermaine Powell has a lengthy criminal history. He was identified as the man found in someone else's garage carrying a baby in January. In that incident, Powell was caught by a Skokie homeowner exiting the garage and then smiling as if nothing was wrong when confronted. After a brief chase, the alleged garage burglar able to get away from the homeowner, police confirmed that he was later charged with criminal damage to property and trespassing in that incident. Powell also has a criminal record that includes convictions for aggravated battery to police officers as well as felony escape from police. And now he is wanted, not in custody, but wanted in the murder of Catherine Benjamin. Our second deal of the day comes from KKTV Channel 11 there in Colorado. An El Paso County Sheriff's Office spokesperson says 27-year-old Ryan Perez stabbed his ex-girlfriend's new boyfriend in a fight outside of a security Widenfield, Colorado home. According to the Sheriff's Office, Perez showed up at the home to confront the new couple. Officials say a fight started. One of the men pulled a knife. Both Perez and the victim were injured by the knife and taken to a local hospital, both suffering non-life-threatening injuries. The victim reportedly stabbed several times. Sheriff's Office says that Ryan Perez is going to be charged with attempted homicide, could also face additional charges as the investigation continues. KKTV says that Ryan Perez has a lengthy criminal history. Court records show that he is currently serving a, are you ready for this, 2-year probation sentence for a felony menacing charge from last year. Mm-hmm. And 27-year-old Ryan Perez out on probation, accused of doing more than menacing this time around. Today's second deal of the day. Now, our good guy of the day from Detroit, Michigan, and the Detroit Free Press. A police officer from Grosse Pointe Park who's working with Detroit police on car thefts. It was last Wednesday. He's out there on the east side of the city. And he notices this pickup that's parked in a field. Just kind of rubbed him the wrong way. Spidey sense started tingling. So he approached the pickup truck. A man got out of the truck, said that he'd run out of gas. And then the guy flashed a badge and said he's with a fugitive recovery team. Well, about that time, the officer saw a woman there in the front seat of the pickup. She was bound with duct tape at her ankles and her wrists, and she had gunshot wounds to each leg. Turns out the woman had been bound, beaten, and shot by her husband. Police believe that he was about to kill his 33-year-old wife and dump her body there in the field. He had already taken her clothing, her purse, cell phone, and thrown him in a field across the street from the field where he was arrested. The badge, obviously, was a fake. The woman is alive and is recovering. Now, we don't know the name of this officer. Sergeant Michael Woody with the Detroit Police Department says this officer definitely saved her life. He is a hero. But the officer is an undercover officer, and they don't want to release his name. Grosse Pointe Park Police had no comment on the case. The field itself, according to the Detroit Free Press, has a history of homicide. Detroit Police Assistant Chief Steve Dolan said it is the same area where two Westland teens who had come to Detroit to buy drugs were found dead back in 2012. But thankfully, this officer, whose situational awareness and whose street sense alerted him to the fact that something was just a little off here, made sure that this woman would not die in that field. And because of his actions, being in the right place at the right time, being curious enough to ask some questions, we thank that officer from Grosse Pointe Park for being one of the many, many good guys out there. All right, we were talking last hour about what's going on our college campuses, not just at Emory University, Harvard University as well. Glenn Reynolds, the guy behind Instapundit, I think I cited Glenn last hour. He's got his latest column up at USA Today all about college campuses and safe spaces, how PC culture is killing higher education. He talked about what happened at Emory, and he said Emory President James Wagner at first showed a bit of resistance to the demands of the protesters, but quickly caved, promising to identify and discipline the authors of the offending pro-Trump writings. The Emory Wheel reported the university will review footage up by the hospital from security cameras to identify those who made the chalkings, Wagner told the protesters. He also added that if they are students, they will go through the conduct violation process, while if they're outside of the university, trespassing charges will be pressed. Glenn says, as New York Magazine's Jesse Singel wrote, the response was, quote, extremely creepy and a sign that something has gone seriously wrong. At the Atlantic, Connor Friedersdorf says that this kind of embarrassing student, quote, activism, quote, unquote, is actually fueling the campaign of Donald Trump. As reasons, Robbie Sawave commented, no wonder so many non-liberal students are cheering for Trump, not because they like him, but because he represents glorious resistance to the noxious political correctness and censorship that has come to define the modern college experience. Glenn says, Friedersdorf makes another point, and one that college presidents should keep in mind. The Emory protesters manage to fill a conference room and meet with Emory President James Wagner, but they don't actually represent the feelings of Emory students overall. Friedersdorf observes, on Yik Yak, a social media app popular among college students in large part because it permits anonymous speech, the Emory student reaction to the chalk controversy wasn't mixed, as often happens when one views that platform during a campus controversy. It was clearly overwhelmingly antagonistic to the student activists. Not coincidentally, some of the demands among student activists around the country is are to shut down Yik Yak. Right? Just make it so we can't access Yik Yak on camp. We don't like this. People can talk anonymously. They can say things we don't like anonymously. Glenn says, freed from a fear that student, quote-unquote, activists and their allies in the students, university student life and diversity offices might punish them, students express their true feelings, and they demonstrate that the activists are a small, unrepresentative slice that is being indulged at the expense of the university as a whole. And indulging those activists, he says, is dangerous to universities because it makes them ridiculous. Glenn says higher education already faces falling enrollments, reduced public support, and a general decline in public esteem. In Connecticut, the state legislature is even looking at taxing the enormous endowment of Yale University. Universities used to be revered, but now, as Walter Russell Mead writes, from the point of view of much of the public, highly endowed colleges are becoming an underperforming asset. The feeling is growing that elite fat cat universities are an expensive luxury and that the money spent propping up their endowments would be better spent buying school lunches for needy kids or topping off the pensions of retired civil servants. Glenn says, when students at Emory University, annual cost of attendance, $63,000 a year, act so foolishly, and worse, are indulged by those who are supposed to supply adult guidance, it gives the appearance that higher education is largely a waste of societal resources. He says that's not a good place to be right now. University presidents, take note. Oh, but will they? You know, look, maybe they will. maybe we will start to see a newly formed spine among some of these university presidents and administrators. I got to say, I'm not seeing much evidence of that yet. And maybe it will be the alumni who lead the way by withholding donations and dollars. There was a statement by a group calling itself Concerned Emory Alumni to the president there at Emory University. And they said, no longer does Emory University serve as a beacon of intellectual diversity, attracting some of the best and brightest young adults from across the world, much as it attracted us. Instead, Emory has become just another school in the well-documented pattern of universities that have surrendered to the demands of a vocal few that emotional comfort, ideological conformity, and yes, safe environments, quote-unquote, trump fundamental notions of free speech. Critical thinking and exposure to other opinions are unwanted. But this does not have to be how the story ends. It is vitally important that we respond to this trend by reaffirming our foundational notions of freedom. Unfortunately, they write, President Wagner and Emory University have thus far failed to rise to the occasion. They say, we call on President Wagner and the full administrative body of Emory University to publicly acknowledge the intrinsic value of free speech and the right of all to engage in spirited political debate. By letting a small cadre of overly sensitive students affect a heckler's veto on a universal right, President Wagner and Emory University have contributed to the erosion of fundamental freedom in this country. It is incumbent on all to fight to protect free speech, especially speech that might be unpopular or viewed by some as, quote-unquote, dangerous. And fight we will, they say. How, I guess, is the next question. Again, I'm guessing withholding donations can be fairly effective when it comes to an alumni response. All right, we're going to take a quick timeout. When we return to the program, Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom drops by for this week's Liberty Update. Stick around. We'll be right back with more NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this. Welcome on set, our friend Melissa Bachman, the host of Deadly Passion on Sportsman Channel. Melissa, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure. I wish I could be there in person, but unfortunately the winter weather is not cooperating with us. So tell me, what's going on in your world? What are you working on in 2016?
Well, right now I just got started on Season 5, and I'm really excited about this season. We've been on the air for quite a while now, Season 5, but one thing that I actually brought that's brand new that I've been trying to brainstorm for several years is a new segment called Memory Chase, and that's all about trying to get more kids involved. And the reason I did it is I wanted viewers at home to have a chance to send in their kids' footage. I remember when I was little, I used to look through our outdoor news newspaper and look for photos of other kids and then always want to submit mine. So it's kind of the same idea. So what I'm doing is about a minute and a half segment for those kids who get picked, and then their footage can be on TV. They get a huge prize pack. Just a really good way to get more kids involved.
Oh, that's really, really cool. And again, I mean, reaching back to your own childhood, we know that, look, we know that bringing kids into the world of the outdoors is critical. And it's not just critical for the industry. It's critical for the next generation. You know, I as a father of five, I want my kids to understand that there is a world beyond the TV screen and their tablet. You know, I want them to get out and enjoy the great outdoors. And unless we actually help them, you know, I don't think they're going to do that. The TV's right there. The tablet's right there. It's so much easier to just stay on the couch, but it's so much better to actually get outside.
Absolutely. And what I'm trying to do is really bridge that gap. You do have so many kids on YouTube. You've got them online. You've got them watching the television shows. So use that medium to get them outside. So that's kind of been the idea behind it. I also know we don't have to give kids prizes for everything, but it doesn't hurt either. So a new bow, all sorts of great stuff. Plus they get to see themselves on TV. We've had a lot of submissions since it started. The first five were amazing. It's just really neat for anybody to see that real reaction from the kids, and it makes, you know, other adults excited and kind of reminds us to do our part as well to get out there and to bring kids along.
The only truly free people who have ever walked this earth have been armed people. capable of defending themselves and their families. Americans look in horror at supposedly free countries all over the world where innocent people live or die at the mercy of their government. We see what it's like to be French, German, or Belgian, where innocent people cower in fear as evil closes in, utterly aware of their own vulnerability, doomed to defend their families with rolling pins and broom handles. Let the rest of the world choose to live in fear. That false brand of freedom will never be ours. We are free to be as armed, trained, and prepared as we see fit. And we will never surrender that freedom to the global gun ban order. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
To the Ayatollahs of Iran and every terrorist you enable, listen up. You might have met our fresh-faced flower child president and his weak-kneed Ivy League friends, but you haven't met America. You haven't met the heartland where the people will defend this nation with their bloody, callous, bare hands. That's what it takes. You haven't met the steel workers and the hard rock miners or the swamp folks in Cajun country who can wrestle a full-grown gator out of the water. You haven't met the farmers, the cowboys, the loggers, and the truck drivers. You don't know the mountain men who live off the land or the brave cops who fight the good fight in the urban war zones. No, you've never met America. And you ought to pray you never do. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Tony Bernardo of the Canadian Institute for Legislative Action coming up a little bit later on in the hour. Right now, I want to welcome from the Center for Individual Freedom, our friend Tim Lee is with us. Tim, how are you, sir?
Doing well. How's everything back at the farm?
You know, things are all right. Where are you, though?
I am in Denver right now, actually. all over the country. You know, sooner or later, I'll be in Phuket, Thailand, or, you know, somewhere in the Caribbean or maybe the Big Island of Hawaii. Today you get glorious Denver.
Well, fantastic. All right. Now, you've got a piece at CFIF. I could talk about this for the rest of the hour here. A tale of two legacies, Reagan at Brandenburg Gate, Obama beneath Che Guevara. Talking about President Obama's trip to Cuba, and we can also talk about Argentina and his comments about communism and capitalism. It just strikes me, Tim, that this was, and this, by the way, that moment where Barack Obama had his picture taken with all of the dignitaries there underneath the picture of Che Guevara. Apparently, he picked that spot out. He's like, hey, what about that as the backdrop there? What does this tell you about who the president is? Particularly when you compare it to somebody like Ronald Reagan there at the Brandenburg Gate and calling on Mikhail Gorbachev to tear down that wall.
Well, that was news to me. I wasn't aware that he actually chose that site. If so, it's extremely damning. What you're seeing on social media among the left is that this Obama pose beneath this giant mural of Che Guevara is no different than once when Reagan spoke or had his picture taken in Moscow beneath sort of a smaller bust of Vladimir Lenin or George W. Bush in China, you know, something along those lines. They're saying, look, this just happens all the time. The difference, of course, is that nobody ever suspected Reagan or Bush of sympathizing with communists. But in this case, if Obama actually chose that site, that just compounds the piece that I wrote last week by 10. The observation I made is that foreign travel and speeches abroad, especially in the sort of the autumn months of a presidency, often define that presidency. You think in 1963 of John F. Kennedy when he spoke in Berlin, you know, the Ich bin ein Berliner, which actually wasn't grammatically correct in German, but nevertheless, it stood as a sort of a symbol of hope for people oppressed by communism. And it showed his forthrightness, his steadfastness against communism, his strength and vigor as a president. Then you think of Ronald Reagan. Similarly, toward the end of his presidency, when he was before the Brandenburg Gate, and he said, you know, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. You know, fast forward to just last week with Obama posing there beneath this mural of Che Guevara. This could be a perfect symbol of the Obama presidency, weak, sort of coddling dictators. And this is something that you and I discussed last week on your show, as a matter of fact. What signal does this send to political prisoners and prisoners of conscience in Cuba when the leader of the free world, or at least the man or the office that was once known as the leader of the free world, the presidency of the United States, is over there visiting and granting legitimacy to a Cuban government that continues to oppress them and imprison them? It's got to be extremely demoralizing, not only to them, but to people around the world who fight for freedom. But it does serve on a bigger picture and in terms of history as something that might encapsulate the Obama presidency, just as the Brandenburg Gate speech did for Reagan, the Berlin speech did for JFK, and frankly, the finger wagging of Bill Clinton. You know, those sorts of things toward the end of a presidency can kind of capture that presidency. And unfortunately, I think we might have just seen it last week under Che Guevara, a murderous tyrant.
Well, and you know, look, I mean, the imagery and the optics were bad enough, Tim. But you know, you could, and I kind of use this excuse. Well, you know, he's in Cuba. I'm sure they picked the spot, as you say. No, it looks like the president had a hand in that. But then he went to Argentina, and he gave a talk, and he said there in Argentina, quote, so often in the past, there's been a division between left and right, between capitalists and communists or socialists. And especially in the Americas, that's been a big debate. Oh, you know, you're a capitalist Yankee dog, and, you know, you're some crazy communist that's going to take away everybody's property. He said those are interesting intellectual arguments. But I think for your generation, you should be practical and just choose from what works. You don't have to worry about whether it really fits into socialist theory or capitalist theory. You should just decide what works. Tim, it seems to me like this is a very dangerous thing to say, to just say, be pragmatic. First of all, I'd love to know, what's the part of communism that works, according to the president? And second of all, you know, it strikes me that this is not some intellectual argument, that in fact what we are talking about are two contrary and competing ideologies and points of view that are in constant contradiction. Communism developed as a response to capitalism. Communism developed as a rejection of capitalism. To say, well, you can just pick and choose, like these are, you know, column A and column B at the Chinese restaurant. It strikes me as absurd, Tim. So I honestly can't believe the president was serious when he said this. Do you think he was serious? Do you think he seriously believes this?
I do, because his intellect, for somebody who's known as such an intellectual president, falsely so, he thinks that these sort of cold 30,000-foot level ambiguous statements like that constitute intellectualism. They don't, obviously. The problem is there are two fronts to the problem of what he just said and the statement that you just recited. The first is a moral one. It goes back to the Cold War again, when there was this two scorpions in a bottle concept, usually among the left, and moral equivalency between the Soviets and the United States, or communism and freedom. There were people who thought that it was just a battle of these two scorpions. Ronald Reagan obviously did not think that. He thought that freedom was right, and obviously a lot of other people thought that as well. But, you know, to draw that moral equivalency is pretty preposterous. But then you get to the second point in this supposed intellect of President Obama. And he says, just go with what works. Well, okay, let's go with what works. Is this man who is president of the United States, is he that incapable of looking around the world at the empirical basis for the objective claim that freedom and capitalism work better? All you have to do is go every year to the Economic Freedom Index put out by the Heritage Foundation and the Wall Street Journal. What they do is they rank world economies on the basis of their economic freedom. And after they do that, they correlate it to a nation's wealth and prosperity and other measures of good living. and there's a direct correlation there. You can plot it out on a graph. But unfortunately, the leader of the free world does not seem to know about this. So on a moral basis, it was flawed, and then on an intellectual basis, it was flawed. So you're 0 for 2 there. And then this is a case where you only get 2 strikes.
Talking again with Tim Lee from the Center for Individual Freedom. I guess the next question then, Tim, is how dangerous do you think it is that the president not just only believes this, but this is his advice to the future generations, right? This is his advice to young voters right now and to people around the world who are getting involved in politics of, communism, capitalism, 6 of 1, half a dozen of the other. Just do what works.
Right. It's dangerous in this sense. There are people in places like Iran and China and Cuba who are fighting for freedom, in Venezuela, people who are actually killed in the streets, in Russia. These are people who actually take a stand and risk their lives for freedom. And when the leader of the most powerful nation on earth, which could lend its support, both moral and financial, to such people, to draw that sort of moral equivalency, it's going to be depressing for those people who are fighting for freedom abroad. And so it's very, very destructive in that effect. It's also destructive in this sense. Think about the entire globe. Can you think of one significant theater in the entire world that is better off today than it was when Barack Obama took office? Even one. If you can, it's probably someplace that most people have never heard of. If you think of the Far East with China, that's obviously not improved. The Middle East is certainly not improved. Iraq, Syria, Egypt, Libya. Sub-Saharan Africa is worse. South America is worse. North America is worse. Every place on the globe under Barack Obama and Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton and John Kerry is worse today. And it's precisely because, or at least it starts with, that sort of moral equivalency and intellectual confusion that is characterized by the statements that you just recited. And so that's one other dangerous effect that it has as well in the real world.
Talking again with Tim Lee at the Center for Individual Freedom. You can read his piece, A Tale of Two Legacies, Reagan and Brandenburg Gate, Obama Beneath Che Guevara, at cfif.org. And one more question before we move on from this subject here, Tim. We've seen today as well, Fidel Castro has published a column there in Cuba mocking Barack Obama, saying that, after all of the sweetness that we heard from the president there, it's amazing we all didn't have heart attacks. Again, say, listen, we'll never forget the imperialism of the United States. We had this new leg in the global apology tour. What does it get us, Tim? I mean, other than companies having access to a new market, hipsters being able to go travel to Cuba before he gets ruined, quote unquote, by capitalism. What do we get out of this? Because, it seems to me like what we are seeing here is another foe of the United States using this to their political advantage, saying, look, we had the president come here on our island. We get to lecture him about the failings of his nation.
Well, there's no gain, certainly not monetary or economically, to the United States. One thing, by the way, that people forget, when they talk about Cuba and they say that it's poor and because of the American embargo, that's not true. First of all, humanitarian aid has always been allowed from America into Cuba. And secondly, all the other countries in the world, in Europe and Canada, they've been trading with Cuba for years and years. That's not what makes Cuba poor. But going back to what we've gained from this, nothing. And frankly, I already talked earlier about the fact that it hurts the cause of freedom around the world and those that are fighting for it, if nothing else on a moral level. But it really has got to be embarrassing for Obama himself. I mean, think about the way he's treated by Putin and the way he's treated by Castro and people like that. Obama sort of bends over backwards to accommodate them. Look at Iran, concession after concession to Iran. And what do we gain for it? They still mock him. They still defy him. In the meantime, with real friends like Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel, for instance, or David Cameron in Britain, look how Obama treats them. He's very, very rude to them and cold. And so he gets no reward for being nice to dictators and then turns around and just treats America's friends poorly. I won't say Obama's friends, but America's friends poorly. You know, frankly, there's the possibility of some sort of mental issue here. I mean, it's masochistic, if nothing else. Every time he sticks out his hand, he gets it slapped by one of these dictators. And speaking of which, you probably saw the images as well after the news conference concluded, where Raul Castro just grabbed Obama's hand and held it above his head, and Obama sort of let it hang there limp-wristed. It was just a really strange view, but that's another one that sort of visualizes the entire Obama tenure.
Well, listen, Tim, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. It is always a pleasure talking with you. Enjoy the rest of your travels, wherever it may take you, and we look forward to talking again very soon.
Thanks a lot. Everybody have a good week.
You too, sir. Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom joining us from the airport there in Denver, Colorado. Yes, Fidel Castro, in a column in Grandma, the Cuban, the official state publication there in Cuba, with a column titled "Brother Obama," says that we should not leave the past behind. So Barack Obama said, "We need to, you know, turn the page. It's a new day." Yeah, Fidel Castro doesn't seem really interested in that. He cited the Bay of Pigs, the economic embargo, as realities that can never be forgotten. So, you know, I mean, again, we can say, Fidel, let bygones be bygones. So you sided with the Soviet Union. So you were willing to put their missiles on your island. So you've held in indefinite detention political prisoners, so you've stifled freedom of expression and criticism of the government. So you've done all of these things. Meh. We can ignore that. We can get beyond that. There can be a bright new day where you can be free to oppress your people, and we can be free to sell our products here, and we can be free to visit your country. What do you say? Castro says, no. He said, nobody should be under the illusion that the people of this dignified and selfless country will renounce the glory, the rights, or the spiritual wealth that they have gained with the development of education, science, and culture. Note, he doesn't say communism. No, it's just the development of education, science, and culture. USA Today says, many have wondered how Fidel Castro has been reacting to the rapid changes that have taken place in Cuba since he stepped down to an illness in 2008. His brother Raul has since changed many aspects of Cuba's communist system, allowing people to buy, own, and sell their homes for the first time, allowing 500,000 state workers to become private entrepreneurs, and ultimately shocking everyone by beginning the process of normalizing relations with the United States. The revolutionary leader did not mince words on the final point, mockingly referring to Obama as our, quote, illustrious guest, before dissecting and criticizing various aspects of his speech to the Cuban people. Castro quoted a section of Obama's address where he discussed the shared history of Cuba and the United States, both colonized by Europeans who depended on slaves brought there from Africa. Obama was trying to make the point that people in both countries are descended from slaves and slave owners, but Castro focused on another population. Castro wrote, quote, the native populations don't exist at all in Obama's mind. Obama also mentioned several challenges facing the U.S., including racial bias in communities around the country and within the criminal justice system. Castro ignored that section, instead blasting Obama for failing to recognize the advances in race relations that Castro and his government feel they've carried out. Castro wrote that Obama did not say that the revolution swept away racial discrimination or that pensions and salaries for all Cubans were decreed before Mr. Barack Obama was 10 years old. Yeah, was it $20 a month? I think is the state income there in Cuba, which would explain why Raul Castro decided maybe we should let some people start their own restaurants and small businesses. You know, people forget, or maybe we never, I guess you have to know it to forget it. People never learn that in the early days of the Soviet Union, right after they tried to collectivize everything and scrap even currency in the Soviet Union, go to a barter system. Lenin, this was even before Lenin died, had to reverse course, had to announce the new economic policy, had to allow for the resumption of small-scale capitalism and private ownership because they had failed miserably. But ultimately what was important to Lenin, ultimately what was important to Castro, was not the specific form that communism would take, only that the form that communism would take place with them in power. You know, we see this in China right now, where we've got Western leaders who are writing to China concerned about the crackdown on human rights in China, a country that supposedly is opening up and supposedly is moderating its communism. No, they're letting people buy stuff. Their big revelation was that, you know what? If we let people feel in control of their economic lives, we can control all other aspects of their life. And if people are comfortable, if we raise their standard of living to the point that they're not miserable in their housing, to the point that they can buy stuff in grocery stores, they can get enough to eat, if we can take care of those basic things to provide some level of comfort, then they're not going to complain about the control. Soviet Union never really learned how to do that. Venezuela never really learned how to do that, at least not being dependent on the oil revenues. China has been able to do this in part because of the central control of the Chinese economy, but even that can't last forever. Cuba's trying it now, but at the end of the day, they're only opening up certain aspects of life. Yes, you can buy stuff. You can purchase, you know, material goods. You can even be somewhat materialistic, which would not have been allowed in the communism of the 1950s. Be it in the Soviet Union or China or the communism in the 1960s. But at the end of the day, they haven't given up the most important element, which is, again, control. So, yes, you can buy stuff. Why can you buy stuff in China? Because the government in power has said that you can. In Cuba, Raul Castro has decided or decided several years ago to allow for private enterprise. Didn't say it was great. Didn't say this is the way it should be. It's okay. We're going to make this allowance, which would still indicate that hostility towards things like private ownership and would most definitely indicate that desire to maintain power. That, I guess, is the biggest difference between communism and capitalism that the president completely disregarded. Capitalism, however messy it might be, is ultimately a system in which the people, be they consumers, be they producers, but the people have control. Whereas communism is that top-down, locked-down style of government where the government imposes control over anything that it wants to control and allows for as much freedom of movement as it deems necessary to maintain its position of power. But, you know, again, entire books have been written about the difference. I wish that the president maybe would, you know, take the opportunity on Air Force One. Maybe, I don't know, crack open one of those books to get a sense of the difference between the two ideologies. Tony Bernardo of the Canadian Institute for Legislative Action, he's going to join us after a quick timeout here on NRA News, Cam and Company. We're going to talk about the proposed long gun registry up there in Quebec, which is running into a little more trouble than the gun control advocates expected. Plus, we'll give you the latest out of Washington, D.C. today. The lockdown has been lifted there. The Capitol, the suspect in custody. The visitor center is still on lockdown at this point, but we'll give you the latest details after a quick timeout. Stick around. We've got more. NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this.
Speaking with Jeff Gorman, he's an MP in Australia and also chairman of the Shooters and Fishers Party Victoria. Welcome, sir, to NRA News.
Thank you.
And welcome to the States.
Thank you. I've been enjoying my nearly 3 weeks now. It's an awesome country. I've only managed to fire a gun once. whilst I've been here in the 3 weeks, it's been more or less work.
Oh, that's too bad. Well, you got to have a little, take a little time to shoot. So tell us, Jim, it's great we saw you here and we grabbed you, because let's talk about what's happening down in Australia. What's the latest on the fight for gun owners' rights down there?
Well, as you're aware, the current administration here has been using Australia as a poster child.
I noticed that, yes. Yeah.
So I'm here telling people that all is not what it seems. It's a case of, we have all these restrictions in Australia and their public safety value is actually dubious at the best.
Okay, give us a for instance.
Well, we have classifications of rifles. In 1996, we had a massacre in Tasmania.
Right.
And as a result of that, there was what was called the National Firearms Agreement was forced upon the states. Now, that classifies firearms into different sorts of firearms. A and B category are the normal sort of bolt actions and pump action rifles and
right.
the usual sort of stuff. C category is for .22 semi-automatics and some centerfire rifles. And D category is for all the evil black rifles and so on.
They're so evil.
Now, with the B category, which is the general sort of centerfire thing, you can get pump action rifles, which is fine. But if the pump action rifle looks like an AR-15, for instance, it gets reclassified to the D category, which is all but impossible for a normal person to have. So it looks apparently kill.
Well, Jeff, the devil's in the details, and the bureaucrats really run the world, because they, with the paperwork and the machinations, they can make what seemingly innocuous regulations, Jeff, be very much not so.
Yeah, and that's the point I'm trying to bring. First of all, I mean, for our politicians, is if there's no actual public safety outcome to it, why are we doing it? I mean, I've been a policeman in Australia before, in Victoria. I understand the need for, in our country, some rules that may or may not apply here. I'm not here to tell you how to run your country. But reclassifying a firearm based on its looks, because apparently that's bad. I mean, there is no actual reason for that except an ideological push to get rid of firearms.
Speaking with Jeff Borman, he's an MP down in Australia. He's also chairman of the Shooters and Fishers Party of Victoria. All right, Jeff, so let's recap so far, because I have more I want to talk to you about.
Sure.
All the stuff that the current administration is going around touting about how great everything is in Australia with gun laws, not exactly true.
No. Well, let's also, another thing they talk about, the theft of firearms from legitimate owners feeding the black market.
Right.
They've also coined a term called the grey market, which is for firearms that weren't handed back in 1996.
Okay.
But that's just a cynical way of trying to tie the law-abiding people into the criminals, because what they're saying is these people just didn't hand in these guns. So they're either black or white, as far as I'm concerned. It's either legal or illegal.
Right.
There is no grey market.
Right. A legal gun is an illegal gun.
Yeah.
Right.
So, look, and effectively, the trying to use us as a poster child for gun control is unbelievable. The mainstream media, of course, don't want to have a bar of us. They don't want to have that discussion.
No.
Because we bring a narrative that completely opposes what they say.
It's easier for them just not to talk to you.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. I mean, I've got to say, I haven't had the mainstream media beating down my door to put me on some of these shows where they talk about gun control. But maybe my invitation got lost in the mail.
Yeah, perhaps. Spam email or something like that.
Well, you just can't tell.
Yeah. So what's your reaction? You've been up here in the States in a few weeks. What's been your reaction from folks up here to what you have to say?
It's been fantastic. I'm finding a lot of people, so they'll say to me, oh, look, they'll get my guns over my cold, dead hands and the Second Amendment and so on. But I also point out, people that come to these shows and the Dallas Safari Club convention where I was, they're law-abiding people, they're good people, they put into society. I ask them, do you really want to shoot a policeman that comes to your door to get your guns, or do you want to get shot by them and all this sort of thing? And I think the message I bring from that is, don't rely on the Second Amendment as such. You need to get yourself registered to vote, and you need to punish the people that are trying to take your guns away from you when you've done nothing wrong in the ballot box. And that way you avoid the whole problem.
Almost out of time. Just want to thank you, sir, for what you're doing, and thanks for being on NRA News.
My pleasure.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. sponsored by Nosler. Tony Bernardo of the Canadian Institute for Legislative Action with us on the program right now. How you doing, Tony?
Well, I'm great, Cam. How about you?
I am good. I appreciate you joining us on the program. We've been watching what's going on in Quebec there with a great deal of interest. You know, after the, you know this, Tony, after the federal long gun registry scrapped, Quebec's government said, well, we're going to have our own long gun registry. And they tried to sue to get the federal government's data. They were denied. And so when it comes to the cost now of, and the process of starting their own long gun registry, all of a sudden there seems to be a lot more opposition in Quebec than what was expected or anticipated, at least by me anyway.
Well, yeah, I think it's because this time they seem to actually be serious about doing it. The last three or four times they've talked about it, they've actually put forward legislation, but it never got past first reading. No, they never did anything more than that. This time, I think they're actually going to be moving forward with it, which is really like insane. Because it's provincial legislation, it doesn't have the teeth of Canada's criminal code, which means that the penalty for not registering your firearm is a fine.
It's a fine.
It's a fine. Yeah, they give you a fine. That's going to induce a lot of criminals to get right out there and do it right away. The other thing that's in this particular piece of legislation is the inscription of a firearms identification number. That would be like your registration number. But they want you to actually inscribe it on the gun.
How?
They don't say. Presumably, they want you to take a nail and gouge it into the receiver of your over-under Beretta shotgun or something. I don't know. It's a little bit impractical, should we say?
Yeah.
So it's in committee right now while they examine it to see if they can figure out any possible way to make this actually work. But realistically, if people have to mutilate their firearms in order to register them, and if you don't, the crime is a fine, it doesn't seem to me to be an awful lot of impetus for people to actually do it.
Yeah, no, it doesn't. And you know, look, there's the practical aspect of this. There's the cost aspect of it as well, right?
Uh-huh. Sure,
Quebec, I understand,
yeah.
just balanced its budget, and now you know this comes with a price tag, even if you're fining people for not registering. Any idea how much this might cost, Tony?
Oh my goodness, who knows? I mean, the last time they forecast it, it was supposed to cost $2 million, and it ended up costing $2 billion. Who knows? But I mean, the fact of the matter is, Cam, is if it costs 25 cents, it still isn't worth it.
Yeah.
This is a stupid system. Canada's been down this road. It doesn't work. It just doesn't work. As well, what problem are they trying to solve? Our crime with firearms number has been plummeting for years, many years, at the same time as the inventory of firearms in the country has been rapidly increasing for many years. So I'm not entirely sure what it is they're trying to actually solve.
I guess monitoring of gun owners there. You know, that seems to be the only thing that would solve. In fact, I'm looking here at a story from the Toronto Star that actually quotes Pierre Veilloux, president of l'Association des Policiers and Policiers Provinciaux du Québec. And he says he couldn't point to any particular incidents where the presence of a gun registry helped head off trouble or where the absence of the gun registry has resulted in injury or death. This seems to be one of those, you know, in the United States, Tony, we have a lot of politicians who say we have to do something. Mm-hmm. This seems to be one of those do something things, right? It's something that a lawmaker can do to say, here, I'm getting tough on this.
Yeah, perhaps, but fact of the matter is they had a Sherbrooke police officer and she was killed in the line of duty because she read in the car computer that the man had a prohibition order and that all his guns had been taken away, and when she knocked on his door to serve papers to him, he fired a .338 Magnum through the door and killed her. Okay. Then we've got two of the listed mass shootings that happened in Quebec. Two of them were done with registered firearms, because it doesn't take much intellect to figure out that because the registration number exists in some computer, that you can't commit a crime with it. Of course you can commit a crime with it. It goes bang the same as every other gun. So I go back to, what is this actually intended to do? And nobody can really give you an answer other than that ridiculous old saw about how it'll help the police when they show up at a home in the middle of the night to know there are firearms in it. The question is, how? Of the 14 police officers killed in the line of duty in Canada in the last 20 years, not one of them has been killed with a registered firearm.
Not one.
Not one.
All right. We've only got a couple minutes left here, Tony. I am curious. You know, I've seen a couple of stories indicating that originally perhaps a free vote was going to be allowed on this. Then I'm seeing that, no, in fact, the members of the provincial legislature are going to be whipped. They're going to vote the party line. Does that indicate to you that there is more opposition to this gun registry? And that's why, you know, I mean, it seems to me like if a free vote, if this would have passed a free vote, there would have been no reason to try to call for that party line vote. But now you've got to try to wrangle those recalcitrant lawmakers back into line here.
Mm-hmm. Of course. You know, as you say, if they had consensus, they wouldn't have needed to whip it. The fact is that an awful lot of people are now questioning whether or not this is really all that smart a thing to actually do. So we'll see what happens with it, Cam, I guess. Is that it's going to be significantly modified in committee, but at the end of the day, they have a majority government and they're going to put it through. What good it will do beyond me, I mean, the last I looked, there wasn't a physical border between Quebec and Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
And you can just walk across. There's no border. So how they're going to prevent firearms from going in and out is beyond me.
Yeah, we'll see. Tony, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. Once again, another, I think, ill-advised measure, but we've been talking about this for a while. We'll see how far it goes. And in the meantime, I appreciate you coming on the program. Hope we can do this again soon.
Always my pleasure, Cam. And give me a shout about that United Nations marking system. It's coming to our door very soon.
All right, we'll talk about that. And hopefully we'll get to see you in Louisville, Kentucky at the annual meeting next, not quite next month, but coming up in May.
Sorry, I won't be able to make it. I have another commitment, but I'd love to see you.
All right. Well, we'll catch up soon, Tony. Listen, thanks so much for coming to the program today. It's always a pleasure.
Take care, my friend. Thank you.
Tony Bernardo of the Canadian Institute for Legislative Action with us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. We are, unfortunately, almost out of time on this edition. Music means it's time to wrap things up. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we'll talk with Bethany Bora, producer of the John Cardillo Show, unofficial college correspondent, also a Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum, and Laura Carno of I Am Created Equal, plus more of the day's, all of the day's top Second Amendment news and information. It's all coming up right here on the next edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler.